Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the meeting to discuss the straw proposal. This is on regional resource adequacy. My name is Christina Osborne. I'm with the Stakeholder Engagement Group here at the ISO. Chris Devon is our primary presenter today. He's from our policy team, and also Keith Johnson. And at the table, we also have Stacy Crowley, who's the Vice President of our Regional and Federal Affairs Division. We are recording today's meeting and make the recording available on the initiative webpage. This is for people who maybe can only join in for part of the meeting, or maybe they didn't have an opportunity to listen into the meeting. If you know of anybody who's interested in kind of revisiting, you know, please direct them to the initiative webpage for that. If you have any questions, we'll take questions throughout the presentation today. In the room, if you have a question, just raise your hand, and, you know, we'll, you know, it doesn't matter when. There's no, you can raise your hand at any time if we're on a certain topic. If you have a question about that topic, we're happy to address your question. If you're on the phone, you can just press #2, and that will put you in the call queue, and we'll take questions as soon as we can get to them on the phone as well. So as you are probably aware, ISO loves acronyms. And so what we did, instead of spelling out everything in the presentation, we put the acronyms up front so that you can reference the acronyms. So that way we don't end up, you know, we only had 45 slides as opposed to 100 slides. So after I'm done with the introductions, I'm going to turn it over to Chris Devon. He's going to review the schedule for this initiative. He's going to talk about the regional RA framework. He's going to go into this before lunch and then continue that discussion after lunch. Then he'll review other items that are in the straw proposal, and then we'll talk about the next steps for this initiative. So with that, I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Chris Devon. Oh, before that, sorry, a couple slides for me, stakeholder process. We are in the straw proposal phase for this initiative. We issued the straw proposal on February 24th. We are going to take written comments. Those are going to be due March 16th. We do have a comments template available on the initiative webpage, so please use that when submitting your comments. So, Chris?
Thanks, Christina. Can everybody hear me? Everybody hear me all right? Okay. All right. So on the stakeholder comments we received on the schedule for the initiative, you know, after we had the issue paper, we received numerous comments from stakeholders that the schedule might be aggressive and requested to the ISO allow for more time to complete the scope of this initiative. So some of the reasons why we are pushing for this tight time frame here is the regional integration initiatives that are targeted for completion by the end of 2016. And this is important so we can allow for some of the regulatory outreach that needs to happen with parties like PAC and other entities that are going to be joining the ISO or are conducting these regulatory outreaches for potentially joining the ISO. So that is kind of what is driving the schedule here. But we will be reevaluating the schedule, you know, following this meeting and any of the stakeholder comments we receive on the schedule after today's meeting. So here is the initiative schedule, and I highlighted that where we are today, March 2nd, the stakeholder meeting on the straw proposal. Comments are due on March 16th. We will have a chance for a revised straw proposal, another meeting in April, and then the draft final in May, targeting a June board. Here is the slide for our regional integration activities. Other folks have probably seen this before. This is more of an updated version. So I'll just pause there and see if anyone has questions. Michelle?
If it's red, oh, this is Michelle Keita from the CPUC. A couple of questions. One of which is, could you give us a little idea of when the governance structure will be discussed? It seems to me that the governance structure sort of interacts with this, and so if we had a better sense of when that might be, that would be really helpful.
Sure. So
that's my first question.
Yeah, question on governance and some of these regional integration activities. I'm going to turn it over to Stacy and have her respond. Thanks.
Sure, thank you. Stacey Crowley with the ISO. Thanks for the question. You'll notice that this timeline slightly adjusts the components around the SB 350 work and governance, and ultimately to get to a joint agency workshop on both the study work and the governance proposal. The ISO previously had the timeline showing a governance modifications occurring in the second quarter of this year. This timeline better reflects the sort of sequential nature that's going to have to happen and really also engage with the legislative leadership and the governor's office on how to accomplish this. So I think while we expect this governance effort to begin soon, the final timeline really depends on the pace of the consultation with the California leadership and the leadership of commissioners and governor's offices around the region. So it will hopefully begin soon, and we expect it to be a public process where we would discuss governance modifications before it goes to that joint agency workshop.
Okay, in light of that, do you anticipate that your RA proposal would go before the governance structure is determined? That depending on the governance structure you choose, you might want to consider the RA proposal within the context of the governance structure?
I think that will all need to be taken into consideration. I think this will all, I'm not sure that a final RA proposal document would, I think it will be looked at in the context of a governance proposal.
Okay, so you wouldn't then go to the board in June before you have sort of nailed down a governance structure, is that what you're saying?
Again, the timing is still to be determined, and in large part, this is an effort. The governance modifications will in large part be based on the collaboration with the California leadership and other state leadership. So it's going to be a little bit hard to be determinative right now, but we're going to try to have a public process here shortly based on some of those conversations and the collaboration with that group.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Eric Espenhorst for Seattle City Light. Two questions. One, I'd like to follow up on the governance. The schedule he just showed shows the resource adequacy going to the Board of Governors in June. Is the governance on is it on a similar timeline or not?
The governance conversation will likely not follow a traditional stakeholder initiative path because it is really part of a regional discussion that needs to happen with some of the leadership in both California and other states. So that timeline isn't going to be tied to a board meeting necessarily. The board does want to get engaged. That board discussion might happen between now and that June meeting, but they aren't necessarily tied to a June board meeting date.
Are they tied to any date?
They are tied in part to the legislative calendar. So it is our understanding and goal to have governance modifications at this joint agency workshop occur so that legislative action could occur, and that would then follow the California legislative calendar, which their session ends at the end of August this year. And again, we do intend to hold joint agency workshop sometime in the second quarter or third quarter of this year. It is hard to determine at this point.
Okay. Well, subject to that uncertainty, I'd like to ask about the resource adequacy. The straw proposal still describes it as a framework, which is not a proposal. So is today's discussion on a framework or a proposal, all of which is, of course, subject to the uncertainty of future governance? What are we talking about today, please?
Sure. So let me try to answer that question. I think, you know, it's a good question, but it is a proposal and it is a framework. It's essentially both. So we're trying to, you know, keep it at a high level. I'll actually move forward and go to this slide here. So, you know, in the straw proposal, we did, you know, try to keep it at a high level, a framework, so we can try to talk about some of the concepts and you know, try to build some consensus around the needs that the ISO sees that we have proposed as I guess I would say, framework items. And so this is intended to be high-level concepts that would be more refined as we move forward throughout the stakeholder process as we have additional iterations of proposals.
There's very little time to do that. And
yes, and again, you know, I would note that we are trying to target that June board, but, you know, considering the scope of the initiative, we are going to try to evaluate that after we receive comments on this iteration.
Okay, thank you.
Other question?
Gary Marich, representing AWEA. And my question had to do with the previous question relative to the schedule of all these integration initiatives. Would the CAISO be willing to produce and then maintain a master integrated chart similar to this, a Gantt chart or process chart, so we could really understand how all these pieces are fitting together? I know yesterday there was discussion as well about an interesting item called the transition plan or potential transition agreement, and kind of nuance like that added into the calendar, I think would at least help me understand what's coming first, what sort of critical path for another item. Does that make sense?
Sure. Stacey, do you want to talk to that at all? But, I mean, on this item, we do have the regional transitional part. You see that near the bottom of the slide above the orange. So that's kind of where we're scoping the time frame for that transitional item, all those things like transmission planning process, interconnection process, figuring out load forecasting information, and those sort of things.
Yeah, this is Stacey Crowley. There isn't much I can add. I think the idea is that we needed to understand some of the where some of these current issues are heading, the transmission access charge and resource adequacy, before we could embark on some of these other what we call transitional items. I think they need to still be fleshed out, and then once they do get fleshed out, we'll certainly try to post as tight a time frame as we can around those.
Other questions? On the phone? No? All right. Let's get into some of the meat of the discussion today. So, again, the SRA proposal is supposed to be a high-level framework. We're going to try to build on some of the concepts as we go forward and have a couple of more iterations of the proposal. So the ISO believes that the current RA construct works well. It's based on a bilateral procurement framework. It's overseen by LRAs, local regulatory authorities, such as the California Public Utilities Commission, other state commissions, and would kind of fall under that bucket of LRA, that term that we use. So I apologize if folks aren't familiar with that. but it works well in the current BAA, and the proposed framework continues to rely on that bilateral procurement mechanism and the RA programs that are in place in the other states that might potentially be joining. So the ISO is really only intending to modify the provisions that we believe are necessary for expanding the RA program into multiple states, and it's really focused on the need to have items.
Excuse me, Chris. This is Steve Johnson of the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission, and I looked through the materials on RA, and I didn't quite get, I saw a description of how it was all done, but in your slide previously you mentioned that it works well. What's the measurement of working well? What's the criteria? Do you keep track of how far off your load projections are, and particularly for pockets that need flex reserves and so forth and so on? Is there a metric, a standard, a method of measuring?
Sure. Fair question. And I think it's important to put some context around this item. I've actually spoken with other folks already on this. It's really that slide or that bullet on the slide is really intended to, you know, describe that we've been able to maintain a reliable system, and it's not really a measurement of or any type of evaluation about the effectiveness of that bilateral program as far as efficiency of it or anything like that. So we're really not trying to make any claims that, you know, doing something else or not doing anything at all would have been better or worse, but it's just that, you know, we've been able to maintain reliability, and that's an important thing for the ISO's operational needs.
And so just to put some perspective on it, when we set authorized power costs for...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Yeah, sorry. When we set authorized power costs for our utilities, we use models that kind of fairly unfairly have a great deal of knowledge about the load in the next hour. And so when the utility plans its load, if there's load excursion and it results in higher power costs, they're subject to not recovering all of those costs. So it matters how much, in an economic sense, the load prediction is accurate, and then when it's not accurate, where the costs go, who is charged for them, and who may recover them. So that's what I'm looking for. So that might help inform your work.
Well, and that's a good point. And I think, I would just say that I don't think we're really envisioning that concept as much as far as how things are done today in California. But, it's a good point. We should probably keep that in mind. And so I'll take that back when we're thinking about the next iteration.
Sure. This is Keith Johnson. I guess I just want to embellish a little bit on Chris's answer. I think the answer to why we would make a statement that the program works well is that it's been in place for over 10 years. We've refined it over time. We feel that it provides sufficient capacity to us to be able to operate our markets, and that we have pretty good participation and depth in our markets and liquidity. We've been able to reliably operate the system with almost essentially no backstop procurement required, which is indicative of a process that works well and provides adequate resources. And as you know, we've had very little service interruption, and basically the system has operated very well. We've had very few violations, so to speak, of NERC and WEC. Nothing out of the ordinary from a large utility, if you will. So I think overall we think that it's very successful, and it's a model that we can build upon, and we don't need to start from scratch and try to redesign something new. We think this is certainly expandable going forward into multiple states.
Well, this is Steve Johnson. Just to respond, I didn't mean to imply that you had to rebuild it. I just was hoping that CAISO would be responsive to measurements of success and the metrics for them. I didn't see them in any of the materials you presented, and you're kind of selling your organization to others outside of CAISO, and so I was just making a friendly suggestion that that might help your cause.
Nancy Kelly, Western Resource Advocates. I just have a process request. I'm sitting very close and still having a really hard time hearing you.
Oh,
and I was
wondering
if you would just get closer to the microphone.
How's this? Better? Okay. Yes. There we go. I don't want to lean over too much. All right. Thank you. Slide 13, we are going to describe kind of the process that we envision for how RA really needs to work under this framework. There's essentially seven steps or seven elements to this. The ISO will first do an analysis of our reliability needs. Then state commissions and those local regulatory authorities oversee the LSEs securing that capacity through their procurement processes. The LSEs show the ISO what kind of capacity they have secured. The ISO then performs this monthly reliability assessment. We'll talk more about that as we go through the slides. The next step is the ISO will do that evaluation, and if the minimum reliability needs are met collectively and for system, local, and flexible, then the ISO, will basically be done with the process. If there's any type of a deficiency, aggregate deficiency, then the ISO will notify those LSEs that are short and about how much is needed and give them the opportunity to cure. So once LSEs have had that chance to go out and procure and try to meet those minimum needs that the ISO has told them about, then the ISO will reevaluate again, and if there's still a need for additional capacity, the ISO could make a backstop procurement decision at that point as a last resort for maintaining reliability. So that's kind of just an overview of the process. We'll go through some more of these steps as we go through the rest of the slides. So the ISO, we got a question.
Meredith Youngheim from the CPUC. I just thought it would be helpful to highlight, and I can't remember if the paper does or not, but the one aspect that's missing from this list is the IPER process, which is the process we use in California to agree upon load forecasts for all of our major utilities. And we also have a robust steering committee, I guess you could call it, called the JASC, the Joint Agency Steering Committee, that determines what assumptions go into that load forecast and actually agrees upon them across the Energy Commission, the PUC, and the ISO. And I think that's a really important part of agreeing upon whether or not there is sufficient procurement going forward. Thanks.
Sure. I think that's a good point. I guess when I was creating this slide, I was thinking more of the process that we were envisioning under this framework, and the load forecasting is just an essential part of that analysis of the reliability needs. So I could have probably maybe, explicitly said that. So thank you for your point. Okay, so, sure.
Thank you, Nora Sheriff for CLECA. Following up on Meredith's question, does that mean that you're not envisioning changing that process going forward, or do you envision changing the IPER process and the JASC approach?
We don't envision trying to change that, but we do need to be able to do load forecasting on a regional basis, so there's going to be some adjustments and revisions to overall how we would come up with a load forecast for the broader footprint. But I'll get into that a little bit more in the first item that we get into. So here are the six provisions that we think need to be revised or added for regional RA. Load forecasting is number one, so we'll get into that exactly, that topic right after this. We also think we need a slight adjustment to the maximum import capability methodology. We would like to add internal RA transfer capability constraints to the ISO's RA provisions in the tariff, and this is essentially like BAA constraints. So if there were potentially zones within the ISO where there might be constraints between them, we want to make sure that we aren't relying on too much capacity being imported or exported between those different zones. I shouldn't use the term import and export, sorry, being transferred between those zones. This is similar to like the PATH 26 counting constraint in California for those folks who are familiar with that. The fourth one is the reliability assessment. We'll get into that, and that contains some important items like planning reserve margin and counting values. So number five is allocating RA requirements to LRAs or LSEs. We think that's a minor item we need to kind of clean up, being able to effectively communicate the needs to either the LRAs or LSEs depending on the particular situation. And six is updating the ISO's tariff language to become more generic because right now it's kind of California-centric. So that one's another kind of minor item. We want to clean up some of that language. All right, so we'll get into the different items. The first one is load forecasting. So we can talk about some of these things. Again, this is a little background on load forecasting. It's used to predict the supply and demand needs of the system. There's essentially three different types: short, medium, and long-term load forecasting. For RA purposes, we're talking really about the medium, that year-out load forecast. Short-term load forecasting is more like our operational load forecast, and then long-term is more of the like 5 to 10, 20-year load forecasting used for transmission planning process. Accuracy of load forecasting is of great significance. I think, Steve had already touched on this. It is important for operations and planning and does affect costs. So that's due to the fact that load forecasting is used in the RA process where we're determining the peak system needs. We received numerous comments on load forecasting on the issue paper, ranging, from we need to make sure that the current load forecasting in California is not affected, and how the current process is both transparent and robust in a public setting. And we need to make sure that that also occurs for any load forecasting in the expanded balancing authority area. Also, stakeholders have said maybe we should publish the results of any of these load forecasts if there's the accuracy of those, so that might also touch on some of the items that Steve had brought up earlier. Also, folks mentioned that most of the LSEs in their new footprint might have, a very good amount of experience doing load forecasting, so we should try to, leverage that as much as we can. So as we get into the process we envision, we want to note a couple of things. We really need to be able to balance the current California load forecasting process with the needs of expanding for a broader organization. And we do agree with the fact that most of the new entities probably can effectively conduct their own load forecasting as well. But we want to make sure that the overall load forecast that we get is done in a very robust and transparent manner as well. So we are proposing to kind of blend this approach of, continuing to do the current CEC IPER forecast in the current BAA and receiving other load forecasting from other entities outside of the current BAA in any expanded footprint, and use those to effectively create an overall system forecast. So, in the straw proposal, we kind of go into a little bit of detail on our envisioned framework. We do believe that the coincident system load forecasts for the full expanded BAA would need to be created by the ISO or potentially a third party, an independent third party. This would be based on the LSE's load forecast data and the current CEC's process for the existing ISO BAA. Then the ISO would need to calculate the coincident factor and identify the load ratio share of that coincidence for each of the LSEs in any new BAA. That's used for numerous purposes, but it effectively in this process, it's used to determine what the system needs would be for each LSE's RA requirements.
This is Michelle Kito from the California Public Utilities Commission. Could you comment a little bit on what you anticipate you would do? So, for example, the CEC makes some adjustments for demand response to its load forecast. Do you anticipate not touching those adjustments, or they also make assumptions about behind-the-meter solar? So are you going to take that just as a given?
That's a good question.
Energy efficiency.
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. I think we need to try to maintain consistency in how those things are treated in a broader forecast. I don't think that we would envision changing how the CEC is doing some of those things, but again, we need to try to balance the current process that happens now with what we need to do for the expanded footprint. So I think, if folks have ideas about how we might best do that, I think that's important. But at this point, we haven't gotten into the details on exactly how we would treat things like DR or EE, demand response, energy efficiency, or distributed generation, and those sort of things.
Okay,
well, Chris, let me try to answer your question a little more directly. We envision having load-serving entities or their representatives. So, for example, in the case in California, the CEC is kind of their representative. We anticipate having those load forecasts come to us, and then we would take them. We don't envision necessarily changing them, but we would take them like we would take them from other entities throughout the expanded footprint. I think what Chris has talked about in the process is that there would be a need for someone to look at all of the various load forecasts, and then we talk a little bit about there might be an assessment like the CEC does currently within its footprint of the so-called reasonableness of the forecasts, and what's really envisioned there is, are they consistent? Are they not out of line with, for example, other forecasts that have been done in the past? Are there huge from that, but we envision, to go directly to your question, we don't see why we would not accept the assumptions for achievable energy efficiency or demand response or other things like that or that are embedded in a very robust load forecasting process. And what we tried to provide in the paper that we posted is a description, for example, of the very robust load forecasting forecast that the Pacific Core entities do to give stakeholders a sense of the level of granularity and the elements that are composed within those load forecasting processes. So I hope that helps answer your question more directly.
Yeah, that does help. I guess the question is, if at the end of the day you can do a plausibility adjustment, you can undo all the forecasts. So I guess there would be some question about what kinds of plausibility adjustments you are able to do in your own process.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think we would like to get feedback on what kind of criteria and those things we might want to look at in the process as far as what might trigger us looking at that.
Okay, now, and I just want to bring us back to governance, that I think it would be important if we had a different governance structure where there were an organization of states overseeing this process, we might view this process a little differently. So I'll just add that. Thank you.
So let me add just a little bit to the discussion of load forecasting. So again, I know we've had the question earlier today, is it a proposal or is it a framework? Well, I guess I would describe it as a high-level proposal that lays out a framework. And load forecasting is a perfect example of that. We currently have a process within the ISO BAA where load forecasts are done. An entity compiles the information, does a coincidence adjustment, and then we come up with the shares of the LSEs of the coincident peak requirement. What we're posing for stakeholders at this juncture is, what would we do in a multi-state ISO? There's going to be load forecasts that are going to be needed. They're going to need to go to some party to compile a load forecast, and there's going to need to be a coincidence adjustment, you would think, because everyone thinks that's a good idea, and we do too. So we want to discuss with folks how that might work, who the players might be, what the process might be. We acknowledge that there are kind of sub-issues or nuances to that might be a little prickly, like, as you know, the CEC has the ability to do what they call a plausibility adjustment. If you look over in the MISO tariff, MISO compiles forecasts from entities and they do a reasonableness check. We understand that would probably be a topic of some interest to folks and how that would work, but what we want to focus on initially is these high-level pieces. What are they? And then we can certainly talk in the future about what are the details. And this is only the initial straw proposal. We still have two additional proposal iterations in the stakeholder schedule on the way to potentially, as soon as June, presenting a proposal to the board.
Okay, I saw a bunch of other questions in the room, so we'll go back here.
Yes, Robert Jenkins, Flint RCI. I just wanted to verify a little bit what this forecast looks like. Is this a 12-monthly peak forecast for the subsequent year or maybe 18 months? I think we put it in perspective about how far out we're forecasting, and we can kind of understand really what the potential are for deviations between different forecasting methods.
Sure. So under the RA process, we envision a need for a year-ahead forecast, a 12-month hourly load forecast. So we would be able to look at each of those monthly peaks. Other questions?
Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. So I've got a couple of questions. The first one, so is the KISO envisioning setting up sort of load forecasting, I don't know if you want to call it guidelines or requirements, so that you get consistency from the multitude of load forecasts that you may receive, so that they're all similar?
Yeah, so I don't think we would try to prescribe exactly how they had to be done, but we would envision some sort of a template or reporting type process where folks would tell us how they treated those different aspects, like how, you know, for instance, how they treated their demand response or their assumptions on energy efficiency and those type of things. So I hope that kind of answers your question.
Sort of. So then you may get forecasts that are, you know, one includes DR, one doesn't include DR. Then to make them consistent, KISO then would have to make some adjustment.
Potentially.
why not have the person providing that, who's probably closest to the GER, make the adjustment?
Yeah, and I think these are good questions, but again, I don't think we've gotten into the details on that kind of actual part of
the proposal. Maybe that's for the next proposal.
Yeah, I think we do need to touch on that, but go ahead.
So Paul, I think what we'd like to encourage today is a good discussion, and we're not necessarily going to have answers to all of your questions, but please keep asking them. I think it raises, in my mind, when you say that, I guess we could say to folks that are all listening on the phone and here in the room, what do you think we should do? I suspect that there are some folks that would say, I don't want to fill out a template. I want to do it my own way. The ISO should not be telling me how to do it, should not be a template, providing a template. There may be others that say we think it's essential that there be a template and that everyone needs to, right, because we don't want the ISO to make adjustments or whatever. So we're very interested in folks' views about what the issues might be, what the elements might be that we have to talk about, and give us some of the pros and cons, and also where you're at, because we're very interested in understanding what the positions of stakeholders would be. We certainly have an obligation as the operator of the system to make sure that we're reliably operating the system, but we also need to be able to develop something that has folks that are all on board with what we're proposing.
Okay. My next question will be a little higher level is the LSC forecasts are outside of California. Is your vision that those should have some sort of vetting by perhaps their regulatory agency?
So, yeah, that's a good question again. I think we would hope that there would be some sort of, vetting by the regulatory agencies. I don't know if it's totally required, but we do also envision, again, potentially posting the results of the accuracy of those forecasts so that we could see, how closely each of those LSEs actually got to reality. So hopefully the combination of those two things kind of touch on that issue.
Did you say publish them publicly?
Not the actual loads, but the accuracy of those. Potentially the load forecast error percentage. I did not mean to say that we would post the, I think that's proprietary information. So.
Yes. okay, thank you.
Right here. No, he was first, sorry. Yeah.
Thanks. Eric Espenhorst with Seattle City Light. Pacific Corp has been participating in the CAISO's EIM for about 18 months now. Are there lessons to be learned there about, because submitting data on load is part of that process, are there lessons to be learned from how the EIM is going so far, or is the full integration sufficiently different that there aren't lessons to be learned?
I think that's a good question. I don't really know how to respond. I'm looking around to see if there's anyone who has.
Well, it's not a quiz, but there is experience between the two entities on providing forecasts of load data. Yeah. This is a
true. I just am not familiar personally with how well the load forecasting for the EIM has gone. So that's kind of why I'm looking for others.
Yeah, this is Greg Cook for the ISO. I would say it's actually quite a bit different process we're looking at here. With EIM, you're really looking at more of a daily load forecast, whereas for RA purposes, we'd be putting together an annual forecast. To put this in context, some of the points Chris is making, that given that it's only an annual forecast, I think that some of the things the ISO would be looking at when we get forecasts from LSEs would be, is there a significant difference from the previous year's actual loads? And then if so, is there a good justification for why they're forecasting somewhat different loads than we saw the previous year, making sure that just a reasonableness check to make sure that there's sufficient justification for the load forecast that's being provided, so that by the time we put that together and come up with a system load forecast, it's something that the ISO has some confidence in.
Well, but if the LSE is responsible for bringing enough resources to be resource adequate, why is there any concern about the load forecast? Because the LSE wears the, as I understand it, the LSE wears the risk.
No, the ISO now is responsible for the balance in authority area reliability. So the ISO is wearing the risk of ensuring that there's sufficient resources provided through the RA process to meet the system needs. So therefore, we need an accurate load forecast to set the resource adequacy requirements.
Well, yeah, well, you've been getting, everybody's load forecast has been too high. I'm not aware of anybody who really does an accurate forecast. But again, so the resource adequacy is adequate to serve whatever the forecast of load is. So to some extent, you have to bring enough resources based on the load. If they don't do that, that's a problem where the ISO acts. But if, you know, the load forecast 12 months from now, you won't know if it's right until 12 months from now.
Right. And that's why that's the one thing you know about a forecast is going to be wrong. But I think we need to ensure that the forecast is reasonable. It's a reasonable expectation as to what the actual system load is going to be. So the ISO is trying to put together all the various load forecasts of all of the LSEs that are within the balancing authority area, put that together as a system load forecast, and that would essentially be the basis then for the resource requirements. If the forecast was too low, we wouldn't have sufficient resources. If it's too high, obviously we have sufficient resources, but the ISO may say that is too high, we don't need that much, and it could be a lower resource adequacy requirement based on whatever the system load forecast the ISO comes up with.
Okay, well then I look forward to the rest of the presentation to see what sort of quality control and intervention the ISO brings between what the LSEs provide and what you actually do, because that sounds like a big step.
Yeah, and you know, just kind of as an overall theme of what's being presented here, you know, we're starting with a very fairly high level framework. I think, you know, the main point here is that the ISO needs to establish a system level forecast as the basis for resource adequacy requirements. Once we can get agreement that this is the right framework and the other elements that are being proposed here today, then the next step is to start moving into how are we going to work out the details as to exactly how will the forecast be determined, what criteria will be used by the ISO to ensure the accuracy of the forecast, the process that would be used to establish the forecast, those types of things will be developed over the next iterations of the proposal.
Noah
Thomas speaking. So as a follow-up to that, it seems like the initiative is generally supposed to be high level, and I didn't understand that to be going to the weeds of the how everything's supposed to be done. So my question was whether or not you expected future initiatives once you've reached the board to split out all these items to have to discuss, or were you envisioning all of that to happen before Board of Governors?
So initially I would just say I think we're hoping that we can try to develop some of these processes and some of the details behind all this and try to get to some of those details that are going to be important as we take this to the board so that people have some sense of what it's going to look like. And we're not just setting up just a process or a framework to be presented to the board. So hopefully we can get to some of those details before we take this to the board. And then there might be some issues where we need to work out things in an additional stakeholder process. But I think the intent is to try to work all these out within this initiative. I saw some other questions here.
Thank you, Henry Tillman, for NIPSE. One of the things I think would be useful for me to have is a timeline that lays out at least the sequencing of these various elements, and you know, as you're getting into more detail in this process, something that you know sets out the you know are the load forecasts and the initial resource designations coming in concurrently, or is there a you know, is which one comes first, which one comes next, what's the, you know, where do the LRAs provide input to the LSEs submissions? You know, it's, I understand there's, you know, you have this annual process and you have a, you know, a monthly process. You know, how far ahead of time are those submitted? You know, with PacifiCorp potentially coming in, you know, how does the IRP process, you know, essentially a two-year process fit into a one-year process. It would be interesting to have a, just have a timeline that laid out, because conceptually, you know, over the course of a year or 2 years, how everything flows through the system.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a good, very good point. As we go forward, I think we can try to develop something like that, where we kind of give folks a bit of a picture of how the timeline might go for this yearly process of including, you know, when we would potentially need the forecast by and those kind of things, when we would be communicating to stakeholders and market participants with needs, and the different time frames that would go into all this. So I think that's really important. But at this point, you know, we were trying to really, there's a lot of moving pieces there. We have the current process that happens in California, and those dates and that kind of time frame that's kind of laid out already. And then, you know, I think we're going to talk with Lake Pacific Corps and see how their IRP process, you know, kind of overlays onto that as well. So I think I can say that in the next iterations, we will try to potentially put together some kind of a, at least, you know, process chart or timeline that kind of explain how that might work a little bit better. Other questions?
Even if it's just something that lays out the sequence of events, you know, if you don't have a specific, you know, number of days to do something,
sure.
Which one comes first?
Yeah, and maybe we could start off at a higher level and explain, you know, just the various sequence of steps, and then maybe, you know, as we go forward, you could talk more about the actual time frame. So, other questions? In the back?
Edison Eliza with BPA. There's a confusion in my mind in regard to, I fully understand the RA program on an annual basis, but the minute you use the phrase of for reliability assessment, and then under the EIM construct is a 24 hours assessment that the participating EIMBA needs to come balance in order to participate into the EIM market. It raises a lot of concerns and issues, and I was at the SB 350 discussions in this room that you guys introduced what is called a day two look to make sure there are sufficient capacities that includes 50% renewables to meet the requirement. Going back to Henry's request, some of these timelines is really critical, and I hope ISO recognizes that there are load pockets within jurisdictional entities that are not jurisdictional, either the state commissions, either CEC, CPUC, or Oregon or Washington commissions. Rather, they are public powers. And at the end of the day, we need to figure out that how the enforcement authority is going to be designed for those entities. I think Eric made the excellent point that as a load-serving entity in those load pockets, I'm going to have a forecast, and I think that forecast may be an adequate forecast for me with the sufficient resources I'm going to bring at the table. But as we go within the year, there are a number of things might change. And at the end of the day, if ISO, through their backstop authority, is going to go procure capacity, the question becomes who's going to pick up the tab for that cost. Is that peanut butter spread among our users? Is that for those specific load-serving entities that end up to be short and so on? Then recognizing this is a framework, recognizing this is a really high level, but under these circumstances, getting into the weeds become as critical to understanding the higher level principles. And anything we can do to help you guys in that regard, we will be happy to get into the discussions and let you know where our load pockets are and what, how we do business today and what changes may be needed as we move forward in tomorrow's construct.
Okay, thanks. So I think you probably raised about all of the important points that we're going to talk about today on through that one comment. So that was a very holistic response. I don't really know exactly how I would respond to that other than just to say, you know, I think, again, today really, and, you know, Keith and Greg have both talked about this, we really wanted to present the framework, the concepts, so that we could get input and see what the different stakeholder positions were on these things. So, you know, if folks have ideas about how we should do things, it's important that, you know, we get that feedback today and through the written comments. So, you know, participation in this process is really important. Any other questions on load forecasting process? Check the phones.
So I know people have been quiet on the phone. We want to give you an opportunity to ask questions. You can enter the queue by pressing pound 2. Just remember to identify yourself first.
All right, so we'll move on. So we'll go on to the MIC item, maximum import capability. So some background on MIC. We did include some of this in the paper just to explain kind of how it works today. So the ISO does calculate maximum import capability megawatt amounts on each of their interties based on the historical import data that's been scheduled in the ISO during the ISO's coincident peak load hours. And this is based on the previous 2 years of data. And we have a calculation for each intertie, and it's for an annual look, and it goes for a one-year term. And we do allocate those MIC values to the different LSEs according to our 13-step process. I won't go into the details on all that quite right now. I just wanted to give a little bit of background. But these allocations are made available to the LSEs for use for RA purposes and bringing in imports to meet their RA obligations. We received a few comments on the MIC from stakeholders on the issue paper. There's a number of questions about how this might work. Some of those details, I should note, some of the questions, all the questions are and comments are detailed in the appendix of the paper, Appendix 1 for the stakeholder matrix for all the comments and the ISO's responses, so that will provide some more detail on these. But just high level, the stakeholders said, you know, we might want to analyze if there would be any potential problems with how we use the current MIC and how would we treat, you know, things like pre-existing contractual obligations and those sort of things. So talking with our folks that calculate the MIC, we have determined that we believe that there's only a slight adjustment that needs to be done. It's mostly appropriate how we currently do the methodology and the allocation, and that could be extended to a broader footprint. But the idea here, the minor change we're talking about, is using potentially needing to use non-simultaneous base case studies, and this would allow us to really truly calculate the maximum reliable MIC for those interties in areas where there might not be a simultaneous constraint existing between different areas of the expanded footprint. So this is intended really to capture the benefits of regional diversity and the fact that there might be different areas in the expanded system that peak at kind of disparate times. So I know that's kind of a mouthful and everything, so I'll just hold there and see if any folks have any questions, and I can try to explain this concept a little bit further. So I saw one in the back over here. Could you turn your mic on? Sorry.
Okay, is that better?
Yep.
Okay. Mary Lynch with Exelon. So right now, LSEs are getting allocation of a certain set of, you know, intertie points for RA. And it sounded, I just want to make sure I understood what you were saying. So there may be some changes to the way you're calculating how much space there is at each point based on some more rigorous analysis. Is it also correct that now all the LSEs in the footprint will be getting an allocation of that space so that that which some of us have been getting for the last few years is likely is going to go down?
So the first part of your question, everyone would still get an allocation on all the different intertie points, but remember, it might not go down because we're going to be adding in a lot more import capability overall when we add other areas of the footprint. So, you know, currently if we have 15,000 megawatts of MIC and that's allocated to all the parties within the current BAA, if we bring in PacifiCorp and they add, say, another 5,000 megawatts of MIC, then we would be allocating the overall 20,000 megawatts of MIC across those interties. So you could see that there might be potential for variation in what folks see their allocations being, but hopefully it should be pretty consistent with what they have today or potentially larger.
Right. So, but all LSEs in the combined footprint are going to get an allocation of the available space at each point. There just may be more points. So overall, you might be getting the same amount, but where you're getting it is going to change.
So hopefully, you know, we can maintain close to what folks have now on their current ear tie points so it doesn't affect, you know, any of their existing contracting and that sort of thing. But, yeah, there's a potential that they might fluctuate depending on the ultimate calculation and the allocation of those to different parties.
So you think that the amount of space at points that you've already been doing this for might go up that much that all of us will get about the same allocation we've gotten, even with new LSEs coming in? Or maybe the better question is, when will you know? When will you have?
Yeah, so we need to do more analysis on that. Good, that's a good point. So, yeah, I can't make that claim for sure right now, but we see that there will be, you know, increased MIC overall with adding new entities to the footprint. You know, we need to analyze exactly how that will look. And we've been doing some work looking at the Pacific Core area and what kind of MIC there would be added if they were to join the ISO. So hopefully, as we move forward on some of that stuff, we can eventually, you know, try to portray exactly what might actually come out of the MIC allocations for entities in the current footprint and new entities that might join.
Okay, so do you have any idea when you'll have some first pass at some numbers?
Hopefully we can give you some information within the time frame of the next iteration of this proposal and the revised draft proposal, so hopefully next month.
Okay, thank you.
You know, to some extent, to the extent that we can, so that we've completed any of that analysis. So I'm going to hold you off, Steve, sorry, because there's a couple other people that had raised their hand in the back, so I'll go over here first and then back to you, Steve. Nope, make sure they have the red light on. Press the middle button. There you go.
Sorry. John Fazio, Northwest Power and Conservation Council, also representing the IEEE Loss of Load Expectation Best Practices Working Group. I just have a concern, and I apologize if I don't know the details here, so maybe it's answered in the appendix. I didn't look at that. But I have a concern about using historical schedules to set the maximum MIC. It seems that, I mean, what happens if you have a couple of mild years in California where the schedules are low? Does that arbitrarily reduce the maximum, or am I misunderstanding how that's done?
Well, it would be based on historical data. We also have a forward-looking MIC process as well for things like public policy needs, but you know, I think that there would be the potential that the MIC values would go down a little bit if there was, you know, a number of years of lower loads. But, again, as we look at those, we kind of have some flexibility in looking at the peak days or the couple peak hours of each year. But I don't know if Catalin wants to add anything to that. But I think, you know, generally,
can I add a follow-up?
There's a potential for that.
As the load shapes change in California and perhaps the peaks shift, might that also affect the MIC because you're looking at the schedules, you know?
Well, I don't think if the peak's shifting, that would not affect the MIC values because we would still be looking at what the peak import amount would be at the peak time. So. Catalin, do you have anything to add?
Hi, this is Kevin Beck of the ISO. The current methodology was approved by FERC to a FERC Texan conference call because the parties could not agree on how to stress the system. So, for example, currently, the current ISO interties, if you look at the total transfer capability, if you add all the interties together, it's in a magnitude of about 36,000 megawatts. Everybody knows the current control area cannot import 36,000 to 35,000 megawatts at any given point in time, period. So the question was, so which one is feasible to be transferred in simultaneously? Okay, and of course you can stress different paths in different directions in order to make it simultaneously feasible, yet nobody could agree on a methodology how to set stress mine harder, no stress mine harder. So the agreement was that, okay, we're going to be using historical values, the absolute maximum historical values that have been seen when the loads are above 90% of the peak. Okay, so the current methodology is the absolute maximum historical schedules that came through when the load was above 90%. We wanted to be heavy loads, not very light loads, but we also gave the absolute maximum that came through. So that is the existing methodology. We're actually not proposing to change that. What we're proposing to change here is that because some of the new areas that will be joining the balancing authority area are, their peaks are not coincident with the system peak. They might rely more on imports at different times of the year, and you don't want to constrain them because the simultaneous peak now is going to be on a different time of the year, for one. For second, we don't believe there are simultaneous constraints. If there are simultaneous constraints, like we all know, California has a simultaneous constraint to coming in. So California will stay as one. But probably other parts of the West don't have simultaneous constraints with when California peaks. So there is no really a need to constrain the imports on other ties throughout the West exactly when the simultaneous peak is. It can probably be a little bit more forward and say, okay, you can use peaks whenever some other areas are peaking and give different intra-ties higher number values. Yet we believe those would be reliable, Tom, because we're going to be doing them. We're going to do a deliverability study, and they'll be simultaneously deliverable at those higher values with the resources in those areas.
Okay. What? Just one more follow-up question, if I could. So I understand that, and that I thank you for that description. What if the supply is not on the other side to provide those maximum? I mean, what if the conditions, say, in the Northwest, were not there to provide those? Is there could there be a potential problem there?
So the way the RA program works is we are giving out the capacity on the intertie to load-serving entities, and they can sign anybody they want behind that intertie. Usually there is some generator that can go as far as they want as long as they schedule that generator on that intertie. If they can't find anybody or they cannot find a deal for it, they can always buy internal resources or they can move to a different intertie. They actually have the choice where to put their allocation. Unless they have an old contract, a pre-IRA import commitment, that they're already locked in, which usually they get protection for those contracts on exactly that intertie they bring them on, if for the rest of the capacity they're going to be allocated to them, they can pick what intertie they want to put it on. Okay, on a yearly basis, it gets redistributed every year, but they get to pick where they want to. So if they request on an intertie and they cannot find a deal that year on that intertie, they actually don't have to use it. They can use some internal resources or...
You understand my question. If you expect a certain amount of MIC, let's say, and something happens in the Northwest where the power is not there, then there could
so,
be...
So let me jump in here. So, okay, so, yeah, it's a good question. But, again, the MIC is just trying to be able to assess what the maximum capable imports would be in this simultaneous sense. And so, yes, that's obviously an issue that if there aren't resources backing that up, there could be potential for liability issues, but that's kind of, I would say, outside of the scope of this MIC adjustment that we're looking at here. That's more of a broader question about, you know, availability of resources, and we'll get into the reliability assessment piece of this a little bit later on, touch on that. So, other questions on MIC? Well, we got a woman right in the back here.
There we go. Got it. Bonnie Blair, I represent the Six Cities Group. So a question about the before and after situation. Currently, you have MIC allocations at scheduling points that are at the boundaries of the existing ISO-BAA footprint. And with the expanded, if there's an expansion, that some of those scheduling points will now be internal to the expanded BAA, correct?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. The sum of them would be?
Well, there are going to be some, say, going out to Arizona that are still going to be scheduling
points, right?
And,
yes.
But some that are
yes,
at the
some would be absorbed,
boundaries.
Yes. And then we have new ones on the edges of the new part of the system.
Right.
Yeah, sorry, I understand now. Okay.
So, would you no longer do MIC allocations at those now scheduling points that are at the boundaries that will become internal, or would you do, I mean, will those MIC allocations just go away?
Right, yeah. There would not be MIC allocations on parts, on inner ties that are internal to the BAA. So it would still be on those, only the areas where we're actually having inner tie points with external areas.
Thanks.
Okay, so I saw someone up here in the front, and then I'll go to the back, and Noah.
Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. Getting into some detailed question, I saw the sort of the, this all starts from taking the import at the time of system peak. At least for the California experience, with the impact of renewables, you've got a net load peak, which actually may be when imports are the maximum, not the system observed peak at certain times. So I was wondering if that also sort of needs to be in the scope of what I think you said is minor changes is
okay.
Looking at that.
Catalin, I don't know how to answer that one.
We can. This is Catalin with the ISO. We can look into that issue. The current, just for everybody to understand what the current methodology is the absolute highest imports when the load was above 90%. So, if due to this issue the loads are coming in and out of the 90%, there might be a problem. Else, I don't think there'll be any problems.
So hopefully that net load peak would actually be captured within that 90 percentile that we're looking at, and we can pick and determine the maximum imports that are happening during that time. We look and see all the data and then point to that. Right, Catalin? Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So does that answer? Are you good?
Yeah, I just think it's obviously looks like you were thinking about this. So
okay.
That's good.
Thank you. Meredith?
Meredith from the CPUC. This is a follow-up to Bonnie's question. So your answer to Bonnie's question indicated that the definition of the point at which you're studying the maximum import changes because you would only be looking at points outside of the new expanded footprint as the intertie points at which you're studying maximum imports because all the other points would become internal. So would you then study those points as you currently do, like the path constraint between North Path and South Path?
And, so, yeah, I don't, think, I don't think we would look at exactly each of the different, I would say, interties between internal parts of the system, but we, as part of this initiative, we are thinking about including the intra-BAA constraints. So if there are major branch groups that have constraints, such as like the Path 26 constraint, we would continue to do that. We're trying to extend that process and be able to identify if there are internal constraints that would be limiting the transfer of RA resources.
So then would you also, as part of that, be studying the potential to increase exports from what's currently the California BAA to other parts of the now expanded BAA? And the reason I ask is because something that's been coming up a lot recently is that our current modeling in the long-term planning proceeding doesn't assume any exports leaving the state and haven't for some time, but that could be changing based on our potential for oversupply during certain periods of the year. And so I know that in the benefit study conversation, they've been talking a lot about this potential for California to export more and also, you know, for us to be relying more on the expanded BAA for our capacity.
Okay. So yeah, I think that the idea of the internal constraints concept that we're putting forth, which I'll talk about a little bit more, is really just looking at how much we're limiting transfers between the areas for reliability purposes. I think I would say that the issue that you're bringing up about maybe looking at how we would expand the potential for exporting resources out of the state of California would probably be something that would be done more through the transmission planning process. I don't think that would really be part of the RA concept that we're talking about with this intra-BAA constraint issue.
Well, I guess what I was getting at is that an import constraint is also potentially an export constraint. So, right, like you're going to be studying the potential for two-way flows, not just one-way flows?
Well, yeah, like the Path 26 counting constraint has directional, north to south, south to north. So this concept would, yes, it would have directional both ways. When there is a major constraint that we see we need to limit the amount of RA transfers, we would have a direction you know, going out of an area and into an area that we would look at what kind of limits would be needed to maintain reliability.
Okay, so going back to how what you currently do, on slide 20, you currently examine 2 years of historical import data to identify the maximum amount of simultaneous schedule, and currently that's into California. So if that point becomes a constraint and not an import point, then you'd be studying, you'd only be looking at historical data for energy moving into California, which could discount the fact that energy might also be moving out of California into other LRA or LSEs within the balancing area.
This is Catalin with the ISO. The issues we're trying to raise over here is not really an RA issue per se. So we all acknowledge there might be times in the year when there may be too much generation that needs to exit. Basically, the concept that you have too much generation, you already, what we're trying to do here is to allow load-serving entities to use imports in order to make sure they have enough capacity to serve, let's say, 115% of their load.
Right. I get that.
Okay. But
so
we,
California could be an exporter is what I'm saying, and someone else could potentially plan for that and rely upon it in their RA program, in theory.
If their balancing authority area wants to do a program like that, then they would have to allocate their own imports. We're not allocating exports for an RA because if the load serving entity is outside the ISO BIA, they don't have to make a showing inside the ISO.
I get that. But so my point is that currently, like, California buys a lot of power from Nevada, Arizona. If Pacific Corp wanted to buy power from an LSE that's currently in California and have a contract and use that for their RA program, this study would help to determine how much they could actually buy?
No.
No.
It would not.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to go to Noah first because he was waiting in the queue.
Noah Thomas, DGNE. I wanted to ask if you were going to look at the acquired rights that is currently within the tariff with regards to the branch groups and with coming in 2019.
Yes, so the current MIC process does look at the existing transmission contracts and transmission ownership rights that are currently being used and kind of protects those values for entities that have those, and we would probably need to do that for an expanded footprint as well, and we probably look at the need for maybe some sort of agreement with new parties to how we would treat those current contracts and protect for those in their MIC allocations. That's Bonnie next.
Hi, a follow-up question on the implications of your answer to my previous one. I'm sorry, Bonnie Blair, Six Cities Group. So assume hypothetically I'm an LSE in California and I have a long-term resource from outside of California, and I use that for RA purposes, and I have a MIC allocation that allows me to use that for RA purposes. And then that scheduling point becomes internal to the expanded BAA. How is my RA or my ability to use that resource outside of California protected under the expanded footprint?
So if, for instance, there was a resource sitting outside of the ISO under your hypothetical that you had a long-term contract with, and then the ISO's BAA expanded to encompass where that was actually physically located, then that would just become an internal resource that would be deliverable under the deliverability study. We would look and see what the maximum deliverability was for that, but it would still be treated as a normal RA resource. You could rely on it in the same manner.
So that it the fact that it'd be deliverable within the expanded footprint would allow that resource to continue to serve as RA.
Exactly, and then the only caveat I would add on to that is this internal constraints issue. So if there was, you know, if for instance it was located, you know, in an area geographically kind of far away from the load that you were using it to serve, you know, you would have to make sure that we respected any of those internal constraint limits, like the Path 26 limit. So for instance, if this hypothetical resource was located in an area that had a constraint between there and where you were serving the load, we would just have that allocation process similar to the current Path 26. You would be able to say you wanted to use a certain amount of that resource, or of your allocation on that internal constraint, to use that resource for RA purposes. So I think that the simple answer is you'd be able to use that as a normal internal RA resource.
Okay. Thanks.
I had over here, and then I'll go to the phone, and then back in the back.
Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison. I may have misunderstood something in the discussion about the export of what you said, so I'm going to try to do a hypothetical example. So if PacifiCorp joins, there will still be a intertie connection between the two through Malin, which will be subject to the maximum import capability. Now, depending on all the calculations that the other gentleman will do, that could be either import into California, be subject to this calculation. But if, like the other person from the CPUC says, if all of a sudden we become a big exporter, then that's going to be a transfer into PacifiCorp through Malin. In that case, it's their import constraint,
so
maximum constraint. Is that...
Okay, so again,
if
other entities join and they become part of the BAA, and there was previously an intertie that was going between two BAAs that we were calculating MIC on, then that would no longer become any type of a MIC point anymore. There would only be potential for that internal constraint issue.
We'll go to that, cause I'll do that as
so
a second
okay,
example.
So
I'm saying the Malin, the case where PacifiCorp joins and the interconnections through Malin, that's no longer an internal constraint because it's still an intertie because that's managed by BPA.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Sorry. Okay. So you're saying if there was that intertie point still between the two areas,
right?
So we would study imports into California, imports into the PAC area, and on each of that intertie.
Okay.
Each way.
But if it was, help me, Mead, between Nevada Energy and CAISO, if Nevada Energy joined, that's an interconnection that would now become an internal constraint because that's no longer an import intertie, export intertie, because it's all now internal in the new big world.
Yes, sorry, that was what I was trying to describe with the previous point. But, yes, that's how that would work.
All right, thank you.
Yep. I'm going to go to the phone next.
Okay, operator, we'll go ahead and take the questions in the queue. Just a reminder to please identify yourself first.
Hi, it's Eric Little from Edison. Just a quick question. Earlier there was a question about protecting the value of your RA when this transition happens, and so I want to make sure I understand clearly. The example that it sounded like you gave was a resource-specific resource that was being imported through the MIC process. However, it's my understanding still that this is the one area that an energy-only contract could indeed count as being RA. You would have a must-offer obligation at the intertie point, but you could source that with whatever you needed to. There isn't necessarily a resource that you are submitting to the ISO in your RA plan. So in that case, is that protected, or is it the case that as soon as you go live with the new entity coming in, that RA deal would no longer be valid?
Okay, so for these non-resource-specific system resources that you're describing, it's correct that currently you could show a MIC allocation on a point, intertie point, that you would allocate to use this non-resource-specific resource and then deliver and have a must-offer obligation on that intertie. But I think... as far as protecting for existing contracts and pre-RA type commitments, I think that we would look and see if folks had contracts for, the transmission ownership rights, existing transmission contracts, and then any of these potentially pre-existing RA commitments and try to reflect those in the allocation of the MIC. So I think that would be protected. But if there was not a contract associated with that or some other type of commitment associated with that non-resource-specific resource, then I don't think that we would be protecting for that. Entities would be allocated their level of MIC and be able to allocate that under their certain interties and could use that to meet those needs. Is that clear, Eric?
Yeah, I think so. That's kind of what I expected. I just wanted to make sure I had clarity on it. Thank you.
Thank you. I saw Roberto on the back.
Yeah, we have one more on the phone, too. So let's take the one on the phone, and then we'll take questions in the room.
Oh, hi, this is Susan Schneider.
Go ahead on the phone.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me? This is Susan Schneider, Phoenix Consulting.
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I had a question, and I'm not sure, I didn't see anything in the proposal about it, but if a resource is connected, say, up in PacifiCorps, and then this combination happens, how are you going to decide whether or determine whether that resource, based on, say, their interconnection, whether it's network resource or point-to-point, or how are you going to make a determination about whether that resource is deliverable in the sense that the IFA uses that term and then can be counted for RA?
So, you know, any new resources that would be internal to an expanded BAA would still undergo the normal deliverability analysis that we currently do.
But if they're already operating at the time of the combination, what if they've already got an interconnection agreement, they've already gone through the study process, how will you determine whether they're...
Right, for RA purposes, we would still complete a deliverability study on all the resources to determine their maximum deliverability for the QC values that they could be shown for RA purposes. So, you know, existing resources and any new interconnecting resources, they would all be treated similarly under our deliverability studies.
Okay. So I think, you had talked earlier in one of the earlier meetings about doing this deliverability assessment even for existing resources. But when do you expect that would happen as far in terms of the calendar that you've laid out? When will people know whether resources currently on the system will count and for what?
So we do those deliverability studies as part of our annual RA process. So when entities were, you know, planning to join the expanded BAA, I believe that would be just the normal schedule that we look at the deliverability on resources for RA purposes. I'm not totally familiar with the schedule on that, but you expect that to be a similar time frame.
Okay, so if PacifiCorps was to join as of January 1st, 2019, then presumably you would have the RA showings, say, the year before, the end of the year before, like in, I think it's October, November time frame, is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, so you would have to have done the deliverability study somewhat earlier in, say, 2018 as part of that cycle. Is that right?
Catalin, could you help me out here?
Hey, Susan, this is Catalin. So currently the deliverability studies for the next year are done for all the generators connected to the grid, new or old, and they're done around May, June, for the next compliance year. They're done before the draft NQC list is posted on the ISO website, which is usually around July, late July. But so the deliverability studies are done around June, I would say. So we're probably going to follow the same pattern as we follow today.
Okay. So just sort of put this one to bed, because there's been a lot of discussion about whether, you know, for people who are planning generation now, should they go for a network resource? Should they go for point-to-point, you know, in that construct that's currently in PacifiCorps or some of the other areas that are considering joining? You're not going to do any blanket, if you're a network resource, you get to be deliverable. If you're point-to-point, you know, you're not going to make those blanket things. You're just going to apply the same methodology that you do inside the ISO.
This is Catalin with the ISO. Yes, and we are not making that implied consent today for all the resources in the ISO that are full capacity. So even a full capacity resource today in the ISO may get cut for some weird reason that hasn't happened yet. But in theory, you can see that if, you know, some other resources retire or the load goes down a lot, you could have instances where even existing resources may need to be, we call it a haircut. So we're going to be using the same methodology that we have today.
Okay. Thank you very much for the clarification.
Thanks, Susan. Was there any others on the phone? Okay. I know there's one in the back. still? Do you still have a question?
Yeah, I want to follow up. Edison Elizabeth, BPA. Paul asked the questions and the lady in front of me in regard to the export. When I look at if PacifiCorp becomes the participating PTO and become part of this bigger footprint, we have about 25-30 interconnection points with Bonneville and PacifiCorp, sorry. And it's a question in my mind that what's the category that sits under the MIC versus the internal RA transfer and how that's going to get administrated and so on. It's not only the intertide, known as the PAT 66. There are other flow gates as well that we're currently working with ISO in respect to the EIM transfers. But when you look at the resource deliverability and the reliability in a future outlook, a year from now, it brings a lot of contract path issues in respect to the actual flow issues and how we manage that type of the transmission system. Then, again, I know this is high level. However, it requires to get that level of the discussions between the parties to make sure we all understand how the measurement of the MIC versus internal RA transfer is going to be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the expanded BA one. Now, if ISO wants to do it on their own, within their own current California things, it's none of my business. But when the minute extends outside of the state of California and other tie lines comes into the equation, makes it much more complex.
Sure, and I think under the when we do the MIT calculations and that, we will probably be having to work with stakeholders to understand how the system is, you know, operated and laid out in those areas. As we, you know, work on that, I think that's kind of I would describe that as part of the MIT process that we go through every year. Catalin, do you want to add anything to that at all or respond at all additionally?
Good. No, other than we will be working with you, and we understand PacifiCorp has many intertie points currently.
Yeah, so, you know, we understand those concerns well, and we're going to work through those. So. Any other questions on MIC? We have half an hour to watch. Oh, yeah, sorry, Steve.
Well, this is the question, just an idea. Is there any way to post some kind of spreadsheet that shows allocations or the change in allocations? I mean, currently PacifiCorp can use those interties to what extent there's available capacity and they have rights to it to import to meet their needs 100% if they wanted. And so now we're talking about an allocation of I assume, less than that. So it would be nice if we had a way to calculate that. And I know there's one, like a spreadsheet like that somewhere in this building, but some of the data may be confidential, and so I don't understand to what extent you can
keep
it. So Steve, you know, thanks for the comment. I think what you've heard us say that in some of the, we're currently at a high-level framework discussion. We certainly in the next, we have two more proposals coming out. We can provide additional details, and we'll look into being able to provide some details about what a calculation might look like and the implications might be going forward. Because we know that in next iterations, you folks are going to want additional details on a number of the different elements that we're talking about.
Yeah, just to make maybe a note for PacifiCorp, the intent of doing this for PacifiCorp was to be able to calculate the net benefits, and we're just kind of going along here, and that's kind of on their books to do. So we're getting along and not getting the details necessary to do that kind of input made available. So we're just very conscious of deadlines, the deadlines that others are trying to meet. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. All right, Bonnie.
Bonnie Blair, Six Cities. This may be not the best time to ask this question, but I'm not sure when the right time will be because we're kind of going through topic areas. Yesterday in the transmission access charge meeting, there was discussion about a transition agreement between the ISO and PacifiCorp. And that was in the context of access charge related issues. This is a general question. It applies to MIC. It applies to the other elements of the ISO's RA proposal. But does the ISO contemplate including resource adequacy elements in that transition agreement?
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to John Anders, our legal counsel in the back.
This is John Anders, the ISO. You know, it's a fair question. I guess yesterday in my comments in response to, you know, questions about the transition agreement, I tried to provide some reassurance that its primary purpose was to provide a time frame and a framework within which the parties could undertake the efforts necessary to integrate Pacific Corp into the ISO's balancing authority area, and that we would not be addressing a wide range of specific issues. Our intent is to generically consider all the necessary elements of a regional ISO through the stakeholder processes, not through the transition agreement. There was one particular exception, and we talked extensively about that yesterday, and I won't go into that today. And without, you know, giving up the opportunity to, you know, suggest additional, you know, exceptions, I can say at this time our thinking is that the transition agreement, any exception provided in that would be fairly narrowly tailored and at this time quite limited, as was discussed yesterday.
So
let me add on to that just a little bit. And, you know, like, for instance, we have, when we started RA here, we have pre-existing RA contracts, right? So we're going to need to come to some agreement with PacifiCorp and entities in those areas about how to treat those pre-existing RA commitments as well. So I think there will be some sense of how are we going to actually deal with some of the existing RA issues, and there might be some sort of agreements that need to be made as well in that area, but I think that's kind of separate from this transition agreement that we were talking about yesterday. Does that help?
I think so. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Okay, any other questions on MIC? I'm going to move forward. Try to get through the internal transfer capability constraints concept before we hit lunch, so we have 25 more minutes till noon. This concept is similar to the PAT 26 counting constraint for folks that are familiar with that in California currently. This is essentially the idea of intra-BAA transfer constraints for RA purposes. So is there constraints between internal areas of the system that we need to identify, such as PAT 26, where there might be it might be a reliability issue if too much RA resources are purchased and procured in one area to serve load in another area of the internal system. So currently that's done under, in conjunction with the CPUC and the ISO calculates some of the allocations and things for the PAT 26, but that's not under our current tariff. So we want to add that concept to the ISO's tariff to be able to identify those kind of major internal constraints. A little bit more background on that. So it is like a multi-step iterative process where we look at, you know, how much internal capability there are for transferring RA resources, and we do a netting concept where we have a look at how many resources are being transferred back and forth, and so we can increase the potential for additional transfers if it still is maintaining reliability. I'll stop there because I saw a question real quick. Noah, go ahead.
Noah Thomas, do you do this currently for non-CPUC LSEs?
Catalin, can you help me out there?
Yes. Yes, we do. The process that CPUC has jurisdiction over is actually done for all the load-serving entities, and we do send all the emails out to all the non-CPUC jurisdictions as well. And then they forward the contract data to us, too. So it works exactly the same way for PUC and non-PUC jurisdictions.
And in the next iterative proposal, would you be able to provide
some detail on the expanded area and how many of those internal constraints you might have or see within even PAC's territory?
Yeah, so I think we still have to do an additional analysis. I can't, you know, for sure say that we'll be able to provide a number or where, what ones, what major constraints there might be exactly, but maybe a general sense of what we're, where we think those might be identified. That's
yeah, location-wise, not
sure.
Particular numbers.
Sure. Question in the back.
Yes, Robert Jenkins, Flint RCI. So taking the PATH 26 example, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding it's allocated on somewhat of a load ratio share. Now, will that going forward now be reallocated on a load ratio share, including the entire the ISO balancing area, so that now PacifiCorp and others would be allocated a share of PATH 26? I'm just kind of concerned what that might do to others who are depending upon their current allocation share for their RA commitments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good question. I would respond. I think, yeah, you know, any entities that join the ISO would probably be allocated shares of any of these internal constraints. So there may be adjustments to the level that folks see for individual LSEs allocations.
And conversely, that means California on a load ratio share would be allocated shares of PacifiCorp internal constraints. It just seems like that could actually be unsettling.
Sure. And yes, this is a very important, you know, issue and obvious concern. And so again, trying to keep this high level, I think, how to work through that kind of an issue. Is there a need to maybe kind of separate, how we allocate those in certain areas and respect those current practices in each of the individual areas for the LSE so that folks aren't, you know, somehow impacted negatively by this. I think that's an important aspect of this entire concept. So we, at this point, we're seeing that, you know, we want to try to extend the current process if it's possible, but please identify those kind of things in your comments, and then if you have ideas about how we might make adjustments in that area, you know, those are things we're trying to get to today, definitely, but it's a very valid point. So,
Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. How does this interact with the local RA requirement that exists? So I'll just be specific. Edison has its allocated amount on PATH 26 in the directional procured locally, then are you still limited by this? So there seems to be an interaction between this internal constraints in this PATH and also the local RA requirements.
So that's a good question. I think I would respond that we're still going to conduct the local capacity technical study, so I think we'd still identify areas where there would be like a local load pocket, localized load pocket, and there would be local requirements for that. And this concept is really not trying to like layer on top of that local requirement at all, but just ensuring that for the way we're doing system resources, if we're transferring, you know, in between areas of the system that might have constraints in the major constraints in a larger area than like a local capacity area, then we would just make sure that we maintain reliability and how much of those system resources are procured in different areas of the system. So I don't think that there's an impact with the local capacity requirement aspect here with this internal transfer constraints issue. But Catalin, would you, you know, have any additional input there at all?
This is Catalin. Yeah, so I don't think that this is correct. We're not trying to change anything that has to do with local. And this, we're planning to do this only on major inter-area constraints that we see on the grid, like, I don't know, let's say PATH 26. If somehow parts of COI would be inside the ISO, maybe on that, or maybe some transfers between PAC East and PAC West, some major inter-ties, not on small things like the local areas. We're not trying to go that granular. It's going to be some really big constraints on the grid that we see.
Does that help?
Somewhat. I need to think about this a bit more.
Okay. Well, you can always talk more offline, too. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Steve?
This is Steve Johnson. Is there any way that GISO could provide a description or criterion or a list of what those interties or constraints would be so that we have some idea of what,
yeah,
what this would be applied to?
Sure. I mean, again, it's kind of what Noah asked. So we're still, you know, looking at the issue, and I think as we move forward, it will be important to try to identify where those are, but, you know, it's all kind of depending on who joins the ISO and what the expanded footprint looks like and that sort of thing. So if we were to, you know, I think try to put out some of that information in the next iteration of the proposal as much as we can. All right, any other questions?
Yeah, this is Michelle Keto from CPUC. I just wanted to say, I think this is, keeps going around, but to the extent that you identify the MIC points and the internal points and actually could tell us whether there's an expansion or a contraction, and then also your methodology, so that, you know, to his point, the more details we have and can see, then we can see whether we're advantaged or disadvantaged or whether our current contracts fall within those parameters. So I feel like more detail is better in this instance to, for us to determine whether it's beneficial or any unintended consequences. So thank you.
Okay. Yep. Yep. We've heard that loud and clear today. So we'll try to get some of that information to the extent we can. Right. On the phone.
All right, Allie, there's a question in the queue. We'll go ahead and take that question.
Hi, it's Eric from Edison. So two quick things. One, the earlier discussion about these internal paths being handed out on a pro rata basis, I'd have to go look again, but my recollection is that these are directional and that the allocation of them is to load-serving entities in the direction that it would be needed. So, for example, today, PG&E does not need an allocation of north to south path 15 to be able to satisfy their RA requirements. They may need from south to north, but wouldn't need the opposite. So I thought that that was the case. If that's not the case, then I think that we ought to be considering that here, because I agree that it would not be, it would not make a lot of sense for PacifiCorp to pick up an ability to bring RA from PacifiCorp's territory all the way down to Southern California.
Yeah, you're correct. So that is how it is done. It is directional. And I don't know if Cattle wants to add anything about the process, but I think we look at it directional, it's pro rata, and then we do the netting, and there's a couple iterative steps that go through, but to actually come up with the allocation on these counting constraints. But you are correct, Eric, that it is directional.
And it's pro rata to load, it's pro rata to load serving load in that entity that the direction is going to, correct?
Correct. That's the first step of it.
Okay, very good. Then the second point that I wanted to make, and just to kind of help clarify here Paul's question on the local, something that we've been thinking about here at Edison is that over the years, the local requirements have gone up considerably. San Diego is one gigantic local area. Edison has a couple of fairly large local areas. PG&E has several large local areas. We presume that there's going to be either one large local area for PacifiCorp or several large areas. And so the question that we're really asking here is, has the ISO looked at whether or not this internal constraint is really still necessary given what's going to happen on local procurement and given kind of the structure of the requirements for procurement by those entities with respect to things like QF and distributed energy resources, those sorts of things? We're just wondering if it's maybe time to relook at whether or not this internal constraint is really still continues to be necessary or is a simplification that could be made at this point.
Okay, so my initial reaction is we still see a need to have these internal constraints for larger areas than the local, but I'll just turn it over to Catalin to see if he wants to add anything.
Yeah, I think you have the next slide to talk about that. I think we'll be looking in the TPP and reassess the need that we have today. We can always look at that. I think we should be doing that.
Okay. I guess we'd be interested in seeing some numbers out of that then. If you have an RA requirement within a specific area and a limited ability to use transfer path to get it there, what is really left over after the local's already been accounted for? How many megawatts are we talking about?
Okay. Any other questions? Right now, okay. So actually, we touched a lot on this. I didn't really go through the stakeholder comments, but we did get a number of comments on the issue paper about what we needed to look at and how these things might need to apply, the directional issue, and should we be enforcing this on gross or net, those kind of things. So again, we talked a little bit about this already, but again, we are trying to make sure that we just ensure that any internal constraints are limited to the point that we are still maintaining reliability and that folks aren't over-relying on resources in areas that might have constraints between those. So I think I've pretty much covered most of the concept on this internal transfer capability constraint, but we have heard, again, I'll just recap that we've heard a lot of you know, requests for additional information and data to support this and for us to do some analysis and look at potentially, you know, the MIC values, that sort of thing. So we will take that back and try to get back to stakeholders in the next iteration of the proposal with as much of that detail as we can. Okay, so a little bit more on this internal transfer constraint process. So we propose that we would identify these major internal constraints to the transition planning process. The capability in each direction would be determined annually. The ISO would provide those allocations on each path on a pro rata load ratio share, and I should specify that it would be in the direction that was necessary for those load city entities to be serving their load, as Eric had mentioned. That's a good point. I did not include that in the slides, so thanks for making that important point. We would continue to protect the existing transmission contracts and transmission ownership rights and any pre-RA commitments in those areas, similarly to what we would do with the MIC allocation as well. And again, we do not allow this netting process. So after we initially give entities the chance to have an allocation, then they can go out and contract with resources in areas across these pathways. Then we would take another iteration in our study and look and see how much this netting would increase the potential for, you know, counterflows that would allow for additional resources to be transferred back and forth between those areas. And then under the current process, we allocate that to the entities that have provided contracts that help the netting, so it's kind of on a ratio of how much your additional contracts have actually increased the capability is how much more you could go out and contract additionally. So we're hoping to extend that exact same similar process for expanded footprint in the areas of the system where we see these potential constraints. So I think that's it for internal RA constraints. I'll open it up again for any more questions, and then maybe we can break a little early for lunch and come back and talk about the reliability assessment and all that. Any other questions right now? All right. Well, go ahead, Christina, take it away.
Okay. So I want to return at 1. Is that what you're thinking? Okay. So, yeah, it's sushi day down in the cafe. You want to get down there early before the employees head down. There's a sign-up sheet that's circulating through the room, so if you could please make sure that you sign it and pass it on to the next person, we'd greatly appreciate it. So we'll see you back at 1 o'clock. Should probably get started. Chris is going to continue the discussion on the RA framework, so I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Chris.
Thanks, Christina. All right. Can everybody hear me? This is good. Okay. All right. So... now that everyone's all full from lunch and tired out, we'll talk about the big items in the initiative. So to start off with, I just want to kind of go over some of the comments we received on the need for resource adequacy standards on the issue paper, and we have raised this concept in the different working group that we had after the issue paper as well. So we talked through it a little bit with stakeholders, and we received, you know, numerous comments on RA standards and the need for you know, balancing flexibility for LRAs to determine their needs and RA programs with ensuring reliability. You know, some folks said we need to be able to ensure that there are enforceable RA requirements so that different jurisdictions can make sure that their LSEs are not being leaned on by other areas. That's one of the important concepts that we want to talk about today is you know, avoiding leaning. Also, we got numerous comments that, you know, sort of describe the fact that right now the existing RA programs work. They're not standardized when we have, you know, the different munis and current LRAs in California, and it works well. So, that, you know, we want to maintain that kind of flexibility as well. So we'll get into this reliability assessment concept, and this is going to really talk about what the ISO believes is necessary to ensure that these various procurement programs have secured adequate resources in order for the ISO to markets maintain reliability. The real intent here is to avoid any potential for leaning by particular entities on other parts of the system, trying to ensure that there is equal levels of reliability across the system. So to perform this kind of an assessment, this again, this goes back to that process we were talking about earlier at the very beginning of the meeting. So this is the month ahead reliability assessment that we are proposing. To perform this, we're going to require three elements. The first is a system-wide PRM to be able to evaluate the total system-wide procurement. We're going to need a set of consistent methods for assessing capacity value of resources for how much those resources should count towards meeting the ISO's reliability needs. And then we need to do some revisions to our current backstop authority provisions just to reflect this reliability assessment and ensure that any potential costs are allocated to the appropriate entities should that kind of a backstop decision be made. So now we'll get into the planning reserve margin. So a little background on PRM. This is a long-term measurement intended to ensure sufficient electric supply in order to meet operating reserves and avoid loss of load. So again, this is really the planning horizon, trying to look at how to meet our peak load plus a margin for operating reserves, forced outages, and load forecast error. This is just a graphical example. Just kind of shows you like a stack of these different concepts. So we have the load forecast, you know, what the peak load is going to be forecasted, plus operating reserves, forecast error, and forced outages. And that gets you, you know, around something like approximately 115% of the forecasted load. So we received numerous comments on the need for a planning reserve margin. Some folks believe we should standardize and have a minimum PRM. You know, other folks wanted us to maintain flexibility for LRAs to set PRMs. So those are both, you know, important concepts we wanted to try to balance in the proposal. Now, this is the actual meat of the proposal. We really need to be able to assess the level of reliability on a comparable basis, and that's the need for having a PRM. We want to establish a system-wide PRM to be used for this reliability assessment, and this would be, you know, not actually assigning a fixed PRM to individual LSEs, but used for determining when the sum of all the procurement for the system is sufficient. So the methodology we're hoping to do for this is we really wanted to, you know, work this through the stakeholder process and get some input from all the stakeholders, and we're going to try to, you know, develop a study through this stakeholder process, and that will help us determine what kind of method we want to use and what the assumptions and inputs we would use for that kind of a PRM study. You know, how much we would update it and those kind of things. All this stuff will be some more of the details we wanted to try to get drilled down into in the next subsequent proposals.
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Michelle Kita from the CPUC. Assuming this goes forward, when would you actually anticipate doing the study? And then I have a second question as well.
Yeah, so I don't think we have an answer exactly of when we would determine, you know, the actual PRM. So I can't really answer that at this point.
Okay, and then my second question is, it seems to me that the planning reserve margin is kind of important for assessing the benefits of this proposal. So let's say, you know, theoretically you go to 17%. Well, then there's no savings for RA procurement for any of the balancing authorities. I'm not saying that that would be the number. But if it's 15%, that's consistent with ours, but above Pacific Coast Current. If it's 13, that's Pacific Coast Current, and then there's some benefit. So it seems to me that the planning reserve margin helps you determine whether there's whether this is beneficial. So maybe it could come sooner rather than later.
Well, I think that's a good point. I want to actually touch on the next slide. So. Kind of describing why we need it and some of the benefits of having a, you know, expanded BAA are having lower PRM. So we think that it's needed so that we can ensure reliability and fairness, but also we want to maintain equal levels of reliability across the system so that folks aren't essentially leaning on others. And one of the benefits of having an expanded BAA is additional load diversity, which will lower the reserve margin requirement for all entities across the footprint when you compare it to what they would have to do standalone. That's important when you think about reserve sharing and the different synergies between all the resources across the broader footprint. I think that it is important that, we try to get the process developed for what kind of a number we might actually come up with, but I don't know if the actual number needs to be used for the benefit study. So that would be kind of my response on that.
Okay.
Item.
And then with regard to the load diversity, it seems to me you could actually, if you have the CAISO's load, if you have Pacific Core's load, you could actually show us the potential load diversity, assuming any number of different PRMs so that we can see that. That would help.
Yeah, so again, as we move forward with more analysis, hopefully we can give out some of those details in our upcoming proposals.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Sure. This is Keith Johnson. I just wanted to add to Chris's answer that one of the things that you'll note, or Chris will probably be talking about, is how would we arrive at a PRM? We just mentioned that it would be done through some sort of a study. The question before stakeholders who are interested in your comments is, what type of study would that be? What would you think would make sense? Would it be a very detailed loss of load expectations study? Would it be some study that was done similar to what was done in California years ago when we established a PRM, where we looked at forced outage rates, load forecasting error, reserve margins that would be appropriate? Would it be a study like that? So that would partially drive the answer to the question of when would we do the study or have the results. We still would like to get stakeholders' feedback, and we need to reach some type of consensus, hopefully, on what type of study we would do.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks, Keith. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. You know, we do need to try to get some input from everyone on what kind of this PRM study might look like. So keep thinking about that, and hopefully everyone has good comments on that in the written comments.
Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. Could you go back to slide 32, please? I just want to understand the kind of the first bullet and the sub-bullet. So CAISO is going to develop a system-wide planning reserve margin so they can check the coincident peak, matches the reserve margin, hopefully life's good, reliability is good. And then that second sub-bullet, system-wide PRM will not assign fixed PRMs. Does that mean these local regulatory jurisdictions could set a different PRM level for their sort of bubble of load?
No, so the intent of that one is that, this system-wide PRM is not going to drill down and look at individual LSEs until we look at the overall system procurement. So if the total system procurement, the aggregate procurement meets the system needs, then essentially the reliability assessment will be done at that point. But if there was a deficiency on an aggregate basis, then we would look at the individual LSEs and say, okay, how much have you guys brought to the table? Have you brought your fair share to meet our minimum PRM? So the intent of that bullet is actually just to say that LSEs could procure to whatever level that they chose, but they might, there might be some level of risk associated with that if overall, collectively or on the aggregate, there was not enough system capacity. Is that clear?
Somewhat. So if there's a local regulatory jurisdiction that has a reliability process, you know, maybe parallel to what California has, and they determine and say, yes, this is the amount of reserves reliability for their, well, I call their bubble, but then you do the bigger one, you say, nope, that local is actually, your value is actually deficient. Is that a possible outcome? So you get sort of a disagreement between the CAISO looking at it wide, going, when they break this down into a local, into a, you know, local area, that you're actually deficient, but their process may say, nope, we are sufficient. Is that a possible outcome?
Go ahead, Keith. So, Paul, let me try to answer it in the following way, and I think Chris is about to, if he hasn't already, talk to you a little more about one of the key pieces of this framework is that the ISO fully intends, as we do today, and even more so going forward, clearly communicating what our operational and reliability needs are. So we currently do that with a local capacity study that we do every year. We do a flexibility study. We're also planning to do a study, I don't know if we do it every year, with a PRM. So our operational needs are known so that LSEs, LRAs can then take that into account when they do their procurement. We do not dictate how folks do procurement. Let me talk a little bit about load forecasting to build on the conversation of earlier. What we are proposing in load forecasting is that the ISO or some entity will determine the system coincidence and the shares of that by load serving entities. That information would be provided to them, and I think we've been fairly clear, for example, in our current BAA, that the entities would know what their shares of their LSE's coincident load was, but we're not going to dictate as the ISO what the planning reserve margin is that would be added on top of that load. That's the responsibility, the authority, the jurisdiction of other entities. So, for example, the California Public Utilities Commission would determine what their adder is, if you will, whether it's 15% or what, to the load forecast, and they would direct procurement as they do today. Other entities in other areas could do the same. What the point of the second sub-bullet is that the ISO, through the study that would be published long in advance, of any procurement that occurred, people would know what the assessment PRM would be if entities choose to procure significantly less than that on a PRM basis. This is where Chris is going with. There's a potential that we might come up short on a system-wide basis against the PRM that the ISO will use only for doing the reliability assessment. It is not binding on individual entities, load-serving entities or LRAs. This is what we mean by it's determined before we go into the operating year or operating month what the planning reserve margin needed is to reliably operate the system, and then every month we get capacity showings in and we put them all in a hopper and we look at the total amount of capacity that's been procured and we say, how did we do?
Noah?
Noah Thomas, did you? So is it safe to say, I want to make sure I'm understanding this, that if the ISO sets a PRM at 10% and CPUC sets it at 15%, then but another LRA sets it at 2%, at the end of the day, if there's a collective deficiency that does not meet the ISO 10% mark, the ISO then would do backstop procurement, or that if it doesn't miss the mark that and somebody brought in less than the 15 or less than the 2, then essentially there's ability to lean on other LRAs and the ISO still doesn't issue the PM.
Yeah, so it's kind of similar to what we see happening today, where most of the CPUC jurisdictional entities, all those meet the CPUC's designated PRM, and then there's some other LRAs that may not, meet that. But collectively, on an aggregate basis, system-wide, if we meet the needs, then we wouldn't do a backstop. So that's a similar concept that we're trying to extend here. So, yes, there would be, you know, again, we're not trying to ascribe that each individual LSE must do a certain level of procurement. It's up to the LSEs and their LRAs to determine what procurement they want to do. But, again, we're trying to just inform folks of what our minimum need would be, and then overall, if the system meets that, then we'd be done. If there wasn't, then we would identify those individual LSEs that would be short, and we'd give them a chance to procure additional capacity and cure that deficiency, and then if we needed to, as a last resort, that's when we would do the backstop, and we're intending to adjust the backstop allocation so that does you know, flow to those entities that are really benefiting from that. Or cause those costs. But I'll talk about the backstop part a little bit more later.
Just following up, this is Michelle from CPUC. You just said minimum necessary. So are you aiming at a minimum standard, or are you aiming at what you want, which I think could be two different things?
Yeah, this would be a planning reserve margin minimum requirement.
But what would, and you were also talking about, obviously, the planning reserve margin necessary to meet reliability standards. So how would you determine what is necessary through a loss of load, modeling?
These are all the details that I talked about we want to talk through and work through in this process. So we need to get more input from all the stakeholders to determine what we should do. I mean, we could do an LOLE-based study. That would be kind of a tense modeling effort that we might do that. You know, we could do something like what Pete described, where it was more of kind of how California came up with its PRM historically. So, again, the details, we haven't worked out all the details yet. This is, again, supposed to be trying to keep it high level and, you know, really try to establish some concepts that we can build on in subsequent proposals.
So Chris, let me add this as well. Michelle or Meredith, I can't recall which one of you asked the question, but I guess let's talk about jargon here. You asked about the question whether the attributive minimum is in front of the PRM. I guess I would say that what we're envisioning is a PRM is very similar to the PRM that's in effect at the moment, for example, for a good number of the entities that are in the current BAA, which is 15%. So in other words, there's a 15% PRM that's applicable for a good number of the load-serving entities. If you want to put the word minimum in front of that as an adjective, that's essentially what it is. We're looking at it in that way. It's a planning margin. You could, I guess, if you're LRA, authorized procurement above that, that could happen, but it's the minimum amount that's needed when people are looking at RA and what's required for their entities to bring their fair share of resources to the table.
In the back.
Edison Elizabeth Bonneville, when I look at your example, Chris, on slide 30, gives me the indication that you guys may create the PRM on a subcomponent in order to come with that minimum requirement. Is that a correct assumption? Because you have an operating reserves on the planning side of a 6% that carries into the actual reliability, actual operation, if you will. Is that the same operating reserves? Or
yeah,
not?
So.
Because
the
you got the schedule two, you got the schedule, I mean, there are several schedules under your tariff that as a transmission provider, balancing authority operator that you offer. The question is LSE supposed to carry that as well or not? Then there's a contingency one that you refer to as 6% of WCC criteria is 3% generation, 3% load granted as the 6%. Anyway, my question is not to get to the detail of this, Ruiz, but it gives me an indication that you want to maybe break that out in order to further define what that minimum is. Because in the other space, I don't think so they have gone to that degree of granularity, if you will, to break it.
Okay, so, Christina, can you fix this? So, yeah. Okay, so, okay, I didn't know you just have to touch it. Okay. It's okay, sorry. So, Edison, your question. I'm not totally clear exactly what you were trying to get at, but I think my response would be that the planning reserve margin is a study based on the forecast load, and then all of those other items that are intended to be covered underneath that. And I don't think we would be removing a potential operating reserve part out of the percentage out of the planning reserve. That just flows from the planning horizon into the operating horizon. So we were still planning to carry enough operating reserves in the planning horizon, but then the requirement just drops down when you move into the operating horizon. Does that answer your question?
No, that's okay. We can get into the discussions on this further on, because what I picture what the operating reserves are.
So Eddie, this is Keith Johnson. Let me give you a little history and why this slide is there. For those of you who have been involved in the RA program over the last many years, you probably recognize this slide. We've used this slide, it was first introduced about 10 years ago. It's really intended only as a conceptual illustration of the kinds of things that are important in thinking about a planning reserve margin, and it's really most useful as an illustrative example of the difference between planning reserves, which is really what RA is, planning ahead, what do you consider, versus operating reserves. So the two bars on the left are pictures of planning reserves, and it simply points out that there's a load forecast and that you've put certain items on top of it, which are obviously important to plan for and what we would argue is procure for, so that we have assurance before the operating day or operating month that we have sufficient resources available on the system. The bar on the right is simply just to note the distinction between operating reserves, which are something we need to actually operate the system in the operational period, and that's at a minimum the load plus a reserve margin, because we have a number of criteria that we certainly have to meet. In the middle bar, the stacks on top of there, and this is a discussion that we had within California, was, well, there's the load, and then there is certain amount of reserves that you need to carry as an operator, and we all recognize that there's forecast error. We talked about this morning. Your forecast is never going to be completely accurate. There's forecast error, and then there's also outages. And what this illustration was trying to do was to explain that there's ranges for those on any given day. So, for example, in the summer here at the ISO, we could have 3 to 6% of our resources out on a hot August day just on outages, just due to the fact that these are machines and they do require maintenance, planned or not, and they do break down occasionally. So there's certainly always going to be some forced outage that's going to have to be factored in to protect the system, and we're not going to be right on the load forecast all the time. So if you look at the numbers there, you can see that a range has been expressed there, and what the conversation was many years ago was, what is a planning reserve margin that's prudent to have, and if you add those numbers up, you come up with something between 115, and I haven't tallied the numbers in a while, but it could be as high as 120-something percent. In the current BAA, for a large number of the load-serving entities, they're required to procure 115, which is kind of a, you know, it's not the high end on any one of those ranges, if you will, forecast error or outages, but it's a number that's a tweener, if you will. So that's really the purpose of this. We were not trying to telegraph to you how we might think about it or what the relative amounts might be. I mean, in a way we are, but this is just an illustrative example that we use in our training, for example, to talk with people about the difference between planning reserves, operating reserves, and a planning reserve margin and what might go into it.
All right. So, moving on to the next slide here. The ISO believes a minimum PRM is needed. This is important to ensure reliability and fairness. Again, we can't operate the system at different levels of reliability, and this kind of goes back to that concept about the benefits here. You know, we believe that considering there's low diversity, that the ISO sees that overall the planning reserve margin requirement should be lower for entities that join because of that diversity and ability to share reserves between different areas of the footprint when different areas are peaking at different times. I guess I'll pause here and ask if there's any more questions about PRM before we move on to the counting methodologies.
Meredith. I guess I can ask this now. I was planning on asking it when you got to slide 31, but since you raised the fairness issue, so it is on slide 31 where you have a bullet that says, while flexibility for LRAs, or this is a comment, I guess, it's important for LRAs to have this flexibility, but it's also important that the negative or positive consequences rest with the LSEs that are subject to the LRA's jurisdiction. I don't know whose comment that was. I don't think it was ours, but maybe it was. My question is, currently, it's my understanding that if there is a system-wide capacity shortfall and the CAISO were to CPM for that, that would be, you know, the cost would be peanut buttered across the LSEs within the CAISO. So in the same way, if one LRA decided to have a 5% planning reserve margin and California maintained its 15, but there was a system-wide shortfall across the entire new balancing authority, would it be fair to peanut butter that cost? And is that something that's being contemplated?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Again, I would just first I'll just say that I just kind of summarized some of the comments we got. And again, look at the appendix in the stakeholder in the straw proposal for all the details on who said all these things and all that, and you can see our responses in there. But I think, yeah, we have determined that our proposal is we need to adjust the backstop accordingly so that we can allocate costs to those entities that were actually causing a need. So I'll just kind of run through at a high level and try to describe the process one more time for everyone. So in this month-ahead assessment we would do for reliability, we would take a look at the overall collective aggregate system-wide procurement levels. We would compare that to the minimum PRM. If we did not meet that minimum PRM on an aggregate basis, then we would drill down, look and see what LSEs did not meet the minimum PRM. Then after we gave those LSEs a chance to procure additional resources, then we would say, okay, did we meet the minimum once everyone has had that chance to cure? If we meet the minimum, then everything's all set and we're done. If not, if we still have a deficiency, an aggregate deficiency, that's when we would go and do, potentially make that backstop procurement decision. If there was backstop procurement done, we would allocate the cost of that procurement to those entities that were short. Once they have been, you know, fully meeting the minimum PRM and there's still an aggregate deficiency, then we would do the peanut buttering. So that's kind of the process steps. So we would be targeting individual LSEs that did not meet their minimum requirement if there was an overall deficiency, and then we would be allocating the cost of any backstop to those entities first to bring them up to that minimum level.
Thank you.
Yep. Now, again, this is just the initial proposal, so I want to, you know, reiterate we want to get feedback from folks, but we heard that, you know, there were a lot of folks that were supportive of that type of a concept previously in our working group. So that's where we went in this issue, on this issue in the proposal. But, again, we want to get feedback on this item. This is very important. Okay, any other questions on PRM? All right. So on resource counting methodologies, why does the ISO need them? You know, it's important we have to be able to assess how much particular types of resources are able to meet the ISO's reliability needs. This means, you know, what is the capacity value for resources? How are we going to determine that? The issue is for certain resource types, like variable energy resources, there really isn't a broad consensus on the best methodology for counting those. If different jurisdictions were to choose different value methodologies for certain types of resources, that could cause inefficiencies, inequities, and barriers to trading between different parts of the region where we wouldn't be able to effectively capture those benefits of the diversity in the region in an expanded footprint. So we believe that uniform counting methods will mitigate these issues to some extent. We got a lot of comments on this, wide-ranging comments all the way from, you know, that we some entities believe that adopting a standardized approach for counting would not be okay with them. Others believe that it's necessary to have this to be able to simplify contracting and other things like the ISO's internal RA processes, avoid leaning and some of these inequitable treatment that's potential between different LSEs if they are evaluating resources differently. So the proposal. The ISO is proposing to have consistent counting rules for resources across the different areas and different technologies so that they're treated comparably. We are proposing to develop a methodology for all the different types of resources, and this would be applied during the reliability assessment. So every year we would essentially publish a list of this is what the ISO believes the maximum megawatt quantity that a resource should be available for RA capacity. We publish that ahead of time so folks would know, and we would determine how that those methodologies are all actually chosen through this open stakeholder process, and hopefully we can get good input on that from everyone. We've heard a lot of different ideas so far, but we need more input, and hopefully as we move forward we'll get more details on exactly what methodology we're using for what resource types. All right, so I'll pause there and open it up for questions on counting methodologies.
This is Michelle Keita from CPC. This is a question about DR. What if other jurisdictions use DR to meet their resource needs? Will you be establishing some sort of methodology for DR? Is that in your...
I believe that's under the scope of this counting methodologies would be to look at how we would value the capacity of demand response resources. Any other questions on the back? No?
No, Thomas. So do you foresee a particular initiative for this counting methodology?
So we want to try to get these methodologies determined through this initiative. So in the next iteration of the proposal, we will have more details on exactly, you know, what potential options we're looking at for the methodologies we'd use for evaluating resources. Meredith?
Sorry, this is Meredith from the CPC. Obviously, we'll say this in our comments, but if the CAISO were to use something other than ELCC for renewables, then all of our jurisdictional LSEs would, well, we have a conflict with state law because we actually have a state law that mandates that we use ELCC.
Yes. So, again, we try to balance all the needs of the various jurisdictions. I think that will be important to take into account. So please, you know, put those kind of things in your comments. We will contemplate how to best deal with all of that. Any other questions on counting methods?
Henry Tillman, that bottom bullet, that stakeholder process described there, is that a separate stakeholder process from this one, or is it going to be included in this?
Sure. Sorry. I probably should have said through this open stakeholder process. But again, this is supposed to be high level, trying to put out the concepts, and we're hoping that we can get those kind of details worked out within this time frame of this initiative. But you know, I don't want to say for sure that we wouldn't maybe, you know, consider needing to open a separate initiative for the methodologies for counting resources, but at this time, you know, we're envisioning that we would be able to complete that sort of thing under this regional RA stakeholder process. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add a little more context to the discussion. So I think it's fair to say that from our perspective, the existing counting rules or methodologies that are being used for the various technologies now, we don't take issue with those. So I don't want folks to have some notion that the ISO is going to be issuing a next paper and it's going to have some brand new counting rules and methodologies that no one's ever seen. We're in the process right now of kind of confirming trying to write up what we understand, as best we can to describe them without writing a book, what the counting methodologies are now, and that's kind of our internal starting point. And so what we intend to do in the next paper is share with you what we, at least for discussion, the types of methodologies that we are looking at, and I would anticipate they're going to be very similar to what you already know of today. There is questions about how do you keep those aligned, moving forward. So question was asked about ELCC. Yes, it's under consideration in a number of jurisdictions, maybe implemented to some extent in some, not yet in others. So that's something we'll have to address and talk about. But, our intention would be that counting methodologies are also not chiseled in stone, and that if we establish some at a point in the future that they would never change, the ISO would certainly work with stakeholders to update them and use best practices. But the challenge for us, as you can imagine, if we now are having five or six states and maybe some folks are doing different things and some other state may say their state law mandates Y instead of X, it's going to be an interesting discussion that we're going to need to have.
Over here.
Oh. Peter Griffiths, PG&E. Does that include EFCs in terms of accounting and that sort of stuff, even in light of what the PUC is doing in Track 2 of the 2017 RA proceeding?
Yeah, so we're not envisioning creating counting rules for effective flexible capacity under this initiative. I believe that would be, continuing to go through the other.
So Peter, let me clarify.
I thought you said yes, and I heard him say no. So I'm
well.
Confused.
I think he's misunderstanding your question, perhaps.
Okay.
We're not planning to change flexible capacity methodology, but an EFC is determined through an NQC value. That's part of the formula. So if an NQC was derived on some counting convention, then the EFC value would be reflective. So in other words, we would envision posting and what we can call that today, the NQC list and an EFC list as well.
And that would be used essentially in the ISO's assessment.
Yeah, so this assessment I should have probably described this a little bit further, but we will assess system, local, and flexible needs. Sorry, I skipped over you before. Go ahead.
Thank you, Nora Sheriff for CLECA. So your goal is to have all of these details worked out and presented to the board in a proposal by June of this year, correct? And how will those proposals take into consideration an anticipated decision at the Public Utilities Commission in June of this year on some of the current misalignments in terms of RA counting for demand response?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll look to Keith on that one.
Okay, I'll take that one. So we certainly recognize and we're participants in the PUC's RA proceeding. We know there's a number of elements in that are under discussion, and so we're going to have to do the best we can to work with the information that we have at hand at the point in time that we do present a proposal to the board. So you're right, there's a lot of things under discussion at the PUC, everything from talking about the coincident factor to be used in forecasting, which we are aware is undergoing discussion, as well as how to count DR and some other things. So again, I guess I would say, yes, we understand that. We acknowledge that. We, as I've mentioned, we don't intend that these counting rules will be static in the sense that they would never change, but we're going to have to see what the stakeholder comments are. We're going to have to see what level of feedback we get from folks, and we'll be reassessing the schedule and whether or not we realistically think we can make June with two more iterations of the proposal. But there is an urgency for us to get a framework and the concepts developed, because we are looking for our prospective entity to want to do regulatory outreach in 2017. So we will have to see where we land. But on the other hand, and we're certainly interested in stakeholder feedback on this, is that what do we do over time as different entities develop different RA programs, essentially, how do we deal with that?
Thank you, and I appreciate your concern about the PacifiCorps timeline, and actually, if you could just expand on that, what's driving the urgency there for that January 2018 date?
I'll give you the you know what I understand to be the conversation that is occurring. PacifiCorps needs to deal with the regulatory or state commissions of about five states, and that they need to have a very lengthy interaction with those, and it's my understanding that they desire to have that occur throughout the entire 2017, because it will be quite a discussion. I'm sure the state commissions will want a lot of information, and PacifiCorps will need to be able to go to them, and what they would hope is by the end of this year, knowing what the RA rules, so to speak, might look like. And they would like to know that by the end of this year. 2017 would be regulatory outreach. If we are looking at a go-live date of 2019, January 1, you need the year of 2018 then for implementation and testing, because what we have found, as well as our stakeholders, that can take many, many, many months. And essentially, you only have until about September, October of the year before 2019, where you have to have your systems up and the processes in place and year ahead showings come in. So that's the overall timeline.
I appreciate that. What's driving the January 1, 2019 go live date? I guess that should have been my question.
JD, do you want to try to talk to that?
This is Carolyn Barbash from PacifiCorps. The 2019 go-live is really in looking at all the necessary things that need to be evaluated and analyzed, the stakeholder processes, and achieving regional governance. That's really the earliest date we looked at where we could achieve a go-live date and for California and PacifiCorp customers to be able to start achieving those benefits that we've identified through the benefit study.
Thanks, Carolyn.
And then I'd like to note that it's probably, this is Steve Johnson with the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission. I'd also like to note that it's the 25th anniversary of the beginning of Indigo, which was the first efforts in the Pacific Northwest. So that's probably the real key. So we got to get it done quick.
Yes, I'm sure that was a big driving factor. Okay, there was someone in the back. Okay, Tony.
And Tony Braun for CMUA. Maybe this is a question for John. Help me understand, let's presume we're on the calendar time frame that we are. Help me understand what the relief is going to be at FERC, because obviously there's still a lot of shoes to drop between any FERC filing potentially this year, even a FERC order, effective tariff language, state approvals. What's the relief going to ask FERC to put in place conditionally, or it will be triggered by various factors, the tariff language? What's the concept there?
Sure, Tony. So at this point in time, and we haven't had pre-filing meetings with FERC or even gotten through these stakeholder processes, but in support of the high-level timeline that was discussed at the very outset of the meeting, the thinking was that the ISO would go through its normal stakeholder tariff filing processes and be requesting that the proposed changes to the tariff be made effective within the 60-120-day time frame, potentially a little bit longer than that if we asked for waiver, but well in advance of the January 2019 time frame, because these proposed changes are intended to be generically applicable to any new participating transmission owner. The one on the horizon at this time is PacifiCorp, but if somebody came before then or what, I mean, it's possible. So it would be effective within, the normal time frame after filing.
So they want half of a layer down further. So there are changes to the program, as I understand this, that would affect the ISO BAA. So if hypothetically one of the major states failed to give regulatory approval for PacifiCorp and the proposal didn't move forward, there could still be effective changes to the current RA program.
I'm not going to necessarily accept the premise that without a new entity joining that the changes being considered to the RA program would actually affect California entities.
Sorry, this is Michelle Keto at the CPUC following up on that. So to the extent that you take responsibility for the accounting convention and the tariff goes into effect, doesn't that mean that the accounting convention could potentially change for our LSEs?
Well,
so, David.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is David Zaldo from the ISO. I think one of the key design principles in the stakeholder process, I'm sure Chris has mentioned multiple times, is that the ISO is looking to change as little as possible of the existing RA program. And one reason for that certainly is the issue we're talking about here now, that the changes could go into effect and be effective tariff language before a new participating transmission owner joined. So I think overall, I think in looking at the proposal as it's started to develop, you know, the idea was to change as little as possible, and I think I'm not sure how many concrete changes there really would be, you know, looking at specifically California utilities and specifically utilities in California that are currently subject to PUC's regulatory oversight. I mean, I don't think there was really anything in the framework that necessarily would automatically result in maybe some minor change. I don't think there's anything significant that was contemplated.
So. Yeah, well, I guess a couple of things. So let's say that we go forward, you put in the new tariff language, and no new balancing account actually joins. You've set up a process where you will establish the PRM for California, and you will establish the accounting conventions for our resources even before the 2019 go-live date. So it seems to me that this is actually becomes an important question because it's not even now dependent on a new.
So a new I'll take the point. So we haven't fully developed each element of that regulatory strategy and approach, but if, let's take your assumption, there was a PRM requirement, we would include that in the stakeholder process and receive board authorization for that proposed policy change, and if necessary, to make it feasible to proceed with filing, you know, the majority of the proposed changes or the necessary changes to facilitate the remainder of the integration process and table some small pieces, we could consider that. But at this point in time, we're not aware of a specific element of any of the proposals that we're contemplating that we couldn't put into effect at an earlier date prior, and in fact, well in advance of the actual integration of PacifiCorp.
Thanks, John.
So, one thing I'd add, though, I think, you know, if there were some small details of that nature, I mean, I think there would almost certainly be some level of tariff provisions that would be going into effect on, say, January 1, 2019 or whatever, you know, whatever hypothetical date we have for a new entity joining. So I think if we could, in this process, if we were able to define some very discrete provisions that really, for some reason, we all agreed couldn't go into effect ahead of time, you know, we could perhaps carve those out and agree that those would not be implemented until later. I mean, that's just in terms of the filing strategy and so on, that's something that could be looked at. But I think, you know, there probably would be very few of those, but that might be a possibility to look at in terms of how the filings at FERC is structured.
I'm going to see if there's any questions on the phone.
And just to remind you, if you want to enter the queue, you can press pound 2 on your telephone keypad. And just a reminder to state your name and affiliation before you ask your question.
Any other comments on counting methodologies? All right, well, let's move on. So the third element of the reliability assessment is the backstop procurement authority. We got a number of comments on this backstop procurement from stakeholders after the issue paper. Those also ranged, you know, wide-ranging, that some folks said we should not be doing backstop at all. Others had, you know, said we need to continue to do our backstop if needed. And that many of the folks stressed that the cost of any backstop should always be assigned to those that are benefiting from it or those that have caused those costs. So that's really one of the concepts that we tried to incorporate into the proposal. So I did describe this a little bit, but again, we're reviewing the authority under the current tariff, trying to ensure that we can adjust that so that, if needed, so that it will actually allocate those costs as needed for entities that would be short in that iterative process that I described earlier. I'll go through it again one more time just to drive that home. But again, we believe that this is the backstop procurement is still an appropriate mechanism, and it is an incentive for entities to bring their fair share of resources to the table, or you know, make those available to the ISO to meet reliability. This is really one of the ideas of how we're going to help prevent leaning. Okay, so one more time on the process. This slide describes exactly what I was talking about earlier. So we conduct the month-ahead reliability assessment. If there's sufficient resources in the aggregate, then we're done. If there is a deficiency, then the ISO notifies those deficient LSEs, provides them a cure period. Once the LSEs have had that chance to cure and go procure additional resources, then the ISO will reassess. If there's continued deficiency, then the ISO will make a backstop decision. So, again, really the intent here, we want to make sure that the tariff revision reflects this new reliability assessment month ahead, utilizing the PRM and resource counting values that we talked about earlier. And then we want to make sure that we identify LSEs that haven't met the minimum PRM if there is an aggregate deficiency, and we are assigning any backstop costs to those entities first before we take a look at assigning costs to anyone else. So leave it at that. See if there's any questions on backstop. Steve? Oh, on the phone? Okay, in the room first. Sorry. Go ahead.
Thanks. Eric Espenhorst with Seattle City Light. How long has the ISO had this authority, and during the time period, how often have they used it?
So I'm relatively new to the ISO. Can't remember exactly how long we've had it for, but I don't believe we used it very often, if at all. But I'm going to turn it over to our other legal in the back. Anthony, go ahead.
We've had backstop capacity going back about 10 years now. It's been under a variety of different names. The current iteration, I think, started in around 2010 or 2011, and I believe we used backstop on that about, 12 times, about half of which were related to the unexpected closure of Songs. So we have, as you probably have heard earlier this morning, we have never used the backstop procurement ever for a resource adequacy deficiency. We've only used it in the context of a significant event designation, which is usually an event that sort of occurs, an unexpected event that RA couldn't be plan on dealing with, such as a Songs closure or some significant transmission outages. There was also one instance where there was a natural gas shortage and we had to use that authority. So I think 12 is the number that we've used it since 2012 or 2011. Starting up on May 1, we used to have an administratively set price. We will now be also moving to a competitive solicitation for our backstop procurement starting in May. But again, our our goal is that this be used as little as possible, and I think evidence, certainly more recent evidence, bears that out as being the case.
Yeah, so I should also mention that we have those different flavors that we kind of do. So I was referring to the fact that we haven't done it for RA purposes, and as Anthony just described, we've done it for something like a, you know, system reliability issue when we had the Songs retirement. Any other questions on backstop?
Henry Tillman for NIPSI. Is there any dialogue between the ISO and the LSC when there's an initial determination that there's insufficient?
Yeah, so there's currently that cure period, right? So once we identify that there's a deficiency, we go ahead and form those LSCs that are deficient, so they have a chance to do that additional procurement. So there is that back and forth with the ISO where we inform them that there's a need.
Well, does the LSC have an opportunity to explain, you know, why the ISO determination, why they don't agree with it, and why they believe that they are adequate, or is it just go acquire, go procure?
I don't know about that, Anthony or David, anybody. Sorry.
So let me make sure I understand. Can you restate your question? I want to make sure we answer it.
Yeah,
properly.
And I apologize. I'm not intimately familiar with the California world, but when if the ISO were to determine if an LSC was deficient, would they simply issue a directive, or would they contact the LSC and say, you know, we believe you're deficient, and at that point, does the LSC, you know, must they go sort of start this procurement process, or do they get to have an opportunity to come back and say, no, I think by our interpretation of your rules, we're fine? And I just see if you give me a flavor of how that works.
Okay. I'll do my best to explain it without going overboard, in the sense that, and we would encourage you, if you have questions about backstop procurement, to read Section 43 of the tariff, talks about it in detail, because there's many different types of backstop that can occur, and Anthony's answer earlier was spot on in the sense that, and let me just summarize at a high level some of the different types of backstop procurement. One of the types of backstop procurement is if there is a deficiency in a showing, which is what your question asks about. Another type that Anthony referred to is if we have what is called a significant event where there's a problem on the system that's unanticipated, usually driven by either transmission or generation outages or the combination of, and we just need to have more capacity procured. In instances like that, where it's nobody's fault, so to speak, that procurement occurs and the costs are spread to folks. You're talking more about a deficiency where there's and I'll talk again very, very high level, but very generically, there's a certain resource adequacy requirement. It's well known. It's published. It's publicized. People know what it is. If the party does not procure to that, a deficiency is identified. It's fairly black and white. I'll give an example of local capacity requirement, which the ISO has exclusive authority through FERC to establish local capacity requirements, which are allocated out to LSCs. And so if you had 100 megawatt local capacity requirement and you only showed 90 megawatts, it's pretty straightforward that you're 10 short. The ISO would then say that there's a deficiency, provide an opportunity cure, and if you read the tariff, it talks about the timeline from when the RA showing comes in, and there's a certain period where we identify it, and then there's an opportunity to cure, and then and only then the ISO may engage in backstop procurement. So that's generically how it works, and I just, your question seemed to go a little bit about what if it's not quite clear whether there's a deficiency or not. I'll say this, maybe others can differ with me, but in our experience, those types of things are pretty black and white. But I will add, to reinforce what Anthony has said, the ISO has never, in all 10 years that we've had backstop procurement authority, procured for someone that has a deficiency that wasn't filled.
Anthony?
Yeah, I think the most common discrepancy that would occur would be a difference between an LSE resource plan and the supply plan submitted by the suppliers. And we, you know, we go, our RA group, I don't know if anybody's here, but they basically, when they get the supply plans and the LSE plans, they go through to validate them. And you could have an instance where an LSE puts down that it has 100 megawatts from Unit A, but Unit A supply plan, somebody may have put the wrong number down and said they were only providing 90. And in that case, we work, you know, we'll work those discrepancies out, you know, to make sure that they're correct in the end. But that's typically any the type of discrepancy that occurs.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think that kind of a discrepancy would most likely take place, you know, in that time frame when we have that showings and that validation, which would kind of effectively make it clear when we got to that backstop decision point. So, there, like Keith said, it would probably be pretty black and white at that point.
So this is Michelle Keita from CPUC. There are instances when it isn't black and white, though. I would just point to local showings and the way the CPUC counts CR. So there are instances, and also I would say that you guys, the CISO hasn't CPM'd, but there has been, there are instances where you've identified deficiencies and you threaten backstops. So I just wanted to make that clear. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions on backstop comments? Oh, yeah, sorry, on the phone.
Corinne, we'll go ahead and take the question in the queue.
Fred, could you please press pound 2 on your keypad, please? Go ahead, your line is unmuted.
Hi, everybody. Fred Hewitt, Northwest Energy Coalition. Just to follow up, Henry and Eric have already asked questions that I had, so thanks for the clarifications. I'm still a bit confused about this. In the screen here it says, if aggregate deficiency still exists after cure period, semicolon, some LSEs chose not to cure, only then would the ISO need to make a decision on any backstop procurement. I'm not unclear about this part about LSEs not choosing to cure. Has that actually happened in the past?
Yeah, I don't know the history on if LSEs have chose not to do that, but again, we haven't done it in the RA sense, so I would guess that would be no. But essentially, the point that I was trying to make on this bullet here was that, you know, we give the LSEs a chance, an opportunity to do that procurement to cure any deficiency, and then once we reevaluate that, if there is still an additional deficiency, that would most likely be because those LSEs chose not to cure.
Okay. Just one observation here, and I know Steve and others from the commissions can really speak to this directly, but my sense is this will be an issue, you know, understanding that this kind of provision hasn't been triggered in the last decade, but also nonetheless there might be differences of interpretation going forward. I think our commissions will be very interested in this issue and want reassurance or arrangements concerning, in effect, joint jurisdiction over this issue. So I just want to point that out.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
Karen, were there any questions in the queue? I did see another hand raised, but that might have been Fred's line.
The only one.
Say that again?
That was the only question in the queue.
Okay. Thank you.
In the back of the room.
Robert Jenkins, Flint RCI. Just want to make sure I understand. The deficiency is measured against the LRA's planning reserve margin requirements, correct? So it's not measured
no.
against the Cal or measuring against CalISO's requirements?
Yes. So this would be done. We are proposing that we would do this reliability assessment using the minimum PRM that the ISO determined through this stakeholder process. We would be evaluating the aggregate resource sufficiency based on that planning reserve margin. Meredith?
Meredith from the CPUC. It may be helpful to clarify to his question that there have been instances when the CPUC did not identify a deficiency for one of our LRAs, but the CAISO did. Now, as Anthony said, that has never resulted in backstop, but that discrepancy has occurred.
I was just thinking of a case where the system in aggregate, all the individual PRMs could be met, but the aggregate did not meet the CAISO's target PRM. So each individual would look adequate by their own requirement, but the total system is deficient. And what would happen then?
I agree.
But if everything's against the CAISO's PRM, then that doesn't, it's less likely to happen.
Exactly.
But the state could still say, as far as we're concerned, our LRAs were fine. They met our PRM, and CAISO could, if their PRM was higher, or if there's a deficiency across the BAA, backstop for it.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, Peter Griffiths, PG&E. I guess I'm just from that exchange, I think the impression was given that all LSEs can be meeting their requirements, there not be a system deficiency. That is not correct, and I think the ISO should explain why and how and that is not correct, particularly when it comes to local showings. Because the ISO, all of the LSEs can have met their needs, but the ISO is not getting all of the capacity they need in particular areas. The ISO can then call a deficiency and CPM for that deficiency, even though all of the LSEs have met their requirements.
I'm going to have to defer to someone else on that if there's an expert that wants to talk about CPM.
So Peter brings up, again, there's a number of different, you may have heard people refer to them as flavors of backstop procurement. So Peter brings up a very specific one. It's called the collective deficiency under the backstop authority for local capacity requirements. Again, we've never made a backstop procurement for a local capacity collective deficiency. I guess I'll take a moment and go into how that works. Local capacity needs are identified throughout the system. Load-serving entities have a responsibility for a local requirement if they have load within a load pocket. They're allocated a load ratio share. They're required to procure capacity in a local area. Due to concerns about market power and things like that, entities are not required to purchase specific units or resources within the local area. The ISO does a LCR study every year through a very long and detailed stakeholder process. We post the assumptions, we post the results of the analysis and the megawatt needs in the various load pockets, and we also identify the units within each of the pockets and their effectiveness of each of the units. We do not require that entities purchase from within the menu of resources that may be within a local area specific resources. We allow LSEs the flexibility to go forth and make deals with whatever resources are in that area. As a result, the LSEs may not purchase the ideal or the most effective units within that local area. But what we do is we take all of the procurement, we look at it, we look and see whether or not in each of the local areas the most effective, you know, how did we do? And it's called a collective analysis to see whether or not we have a collective deficiency. And what Peter's going to is if you're LSE1 and you had 100 megawatt local requirement and you purchased 100 megawatts and you're LSE2 and you had to purchase 50 and you both purchased 150, respectively, we do an analysis, and then we say whether or not there's still a collective deficiency that remains because they weren't required to purchase the most effective unit due to things like market power concerns. There may be a very small discrepancy between the units that they purchased that were not the ideal portfolio of resources for that local area. That's what's known as a collective deficiency. Using my example, the difference might be 2 megawatts. The ISO will make a determination of whether or not it really feels that it has to go do backstop procurement for 2 megawatts. This analysis is done year ahead and year ahead only. We've done it every year. We have, and you can look on our website on the reliability requirements webpage. You'll see that we post our initial analysis of the first series of local showings. We then have a second series where we have communicated to people how people did in their initial showings for local. We identify any deficiencies or collective concerns, and what has happened through the years is people procure and basically fill the gap, and we've never had to actually do a collective deficiency backstop procurement. Just a word on how cost allocation is done on that. The concept is that if everyone's procured the megawatt number that they were supposed to procure, and we do need, using my example, 2 megawatts more for some reason that's essential, the ISO would purchase in theory, and then we would spread the cost to the entities, all of the entities, because it's no one's fault, because we did not require that they purchase the most effective. So that's how backstop procurement in that instance works. I know that's a lot to absorb. Key things I want to share with you is Peter's right. In theory, there could be circumstances where everyone purchased everything they were supposed to and the ISO might purchase a little more. We've never actually done that.
So, Tony, go ahead.
Keith, as you're talking and as Anthony is talking, it really, you know, drags up a lot of the development of this program, which, you know, from our perspective, works pretty good. But it is just complex, arcane, and has a long history, and we should give some thought to how to better transmit the necessary information for people to digest this and make some decisions accordingly. Because it's an incredibly detailed step. Step complex, and there's layers and layers of math under it that I don't even understand. And but it just, I think it's unreasonable for people to just digest this all in a relatively short matter of days.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's also why I don't feel comfortable responding to these questions. So
go ahead, Catalin.
This is Catalin with the ISO. On that point, we did talk a lot about that, but that's kind of meaningless to what we're going over here. This was actually meant only for system array and system array only. And so basically what the changes are proposed here is for system and system array. We're not proposing to change all the other flavors of the CPM. Like I said, there are 6 or 7. This is only for the year ahead and the month ahead system array showings, which are 2 of those 6 or 7 flavors. The other ones will probably stay exactly as they are.
Right. So we are still going to do the assessment on the local and the flexible, and if we do need to do those, that would still continue in the same manner as today. We don't believe there's a need to update that type of backstop procurement authority. This one is focused, again, on that system backstop authority. Go ahead, Meredith.
Meredith Youngheim, the CPUC. I mean, I'm less interested in this question, the answer to the question, but others might be. But you would potentially be creating or delineating new local areas. So in theory, your backstop authority might extend to other transmission-constrained local areas within an expanded footprint, right?
Yes. Steve?
Yes. Chris, let me just clarify for folks. The backstop procurement tariff provisions that we have, as Tony points out, has a long history. We're not planning to change them really in any way. What we're really just trying to tell you is if there is a reliability assessment, as we've discussed in the straw proposal, the backstop provisions would just need to be written to acknowledge that there is a reliability assessment. It basically fits within the fence posts, if you will, or the guardrails, if you will, of backstop procurement. It's just acknowledging that there might be, as the gentleman from the Northwest mentioned, you know, there might be a deficiency of some kind, and the backstop procurement doesn't mention anything about reliability assessment being done.
Steve, you have comment?
Steve Johnson from Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission, and just another friendly suggestion. What we're doing here is trying to present a option to integrate PacifiCorp with the CAISO, and with it comes changes that are necessary to make. within the CAISIS framework and with the new footprint. But also with that comes, you know, the CAISIS selling itself and what it does to people outside of the CAISIS region. So while some elements of your various reliabilities and RA requirements may not change, it doesn't mean they don't need to be explained in workshops or other formats. Currently, Pacific War does these activities as a BA, presents them both, of course, toward NERC and toward its state commissions for cost recovery, and under the idea of joining the CAISO, CAISO would take over that role. And so you might want to make sure that people know what it is and get buy-in.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Steve. Thank you. Donnie?
We've been talking about one or several really important aspects of the ISO's RA program, but beyond the point of how much RA should be procured and who should procure it, there's a whole issue that isn't discussed in any detail in the straw proposal and is a very important element, and that is must-offer requirements. And the let me see, resource adequacy, availability incentive mechanism, RAIM, R-A-I-I-M, or R-A-A-I-M. Anyway, that
you got it.
So must offer, and then or availability, to give it a more generic term, availability, and then penalties if a resource doesn't meet the availability targets. There are a couple of passing references to those features of the RA program in the straw proposal. No in-depth discussion. Is it the ISO's intention that those aspects of the RA provisions in the tariff are going to remain in place and basically be applied throughout the expanded footprint?
Yeah. So
Bonnie, yes, absolutely. I, what we're trying to explain to folks is that the majority of the ISO tariff provisions that we don't mention them in our list of the six items that need to be either added or revised, they remain unchanged because they work. So to answer your question about the must offer requirement, and I will take the liberty of going where you may be asking, is, you know, would a new PTO that joins the grid have RA obligations and a must-offer obligation and be subject to RAIM and all that? Absolutely. For example, how are they going to have a must-offer obligation? There's going to be showing requirements. They're going to have to submit RA showings, tell us what capacity is available as RA capacity. There'll be showings that are submitted. When you submit your resource IDs, we put them in the master file and code them for operations and say these resources are RA. They have must-offer obligations. They also have or as you call them, the RAAIM, the reliability performance provision, the RAIM potential charges or penalties, and all of that applies to a new entity that would be joining. We're not changing any of those things. It's similarly why we're not mentioning some of the other aspects of the RA program, because we expect them to work and be expandable, if you will. People take on those obligations if they join our balancing authority area.
Thanks. Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. I'm just trying to understand how a well-behaving LSC might come up with a deficiency. So I kind of want to go back to page 36 and kind of refresh. So my understanding is in this process we're going to develop some sort of a resource counting methodology. And I'm now focusing on the last sub-bullet on the page. So you're going to have then a quantity of all these resources that are published on the ISO's webpage a year prior. So who determines that quantity? Is that the CAISO, the LSC, and LRA?
The ISO would utilize these counting methodologies that were determined through the stakeholder process to develop what the NQCs of those resources would be.
Okay. So the CAISA will calculate all these values using the methodologies.
Yes.
So I guess there'll be some process if there's a disagreement on how much a resource should count because of the interpretation of the methodology.
That's a detail that we could probably talk about a little bit more. But
okay.
Yeah, essentially I think we would be open to talking about that. But, again, we want to try to determine the methodologies ahead of time so people know what they're looking at for different types of resources and how they would be evaluated. And hopefully those could be, again, we're open to adjusting those as we go forward. But once we have them established for that time frame, those values would be static.
And there might be some lag issues because it's the year prior in this process, but I won't delve into that. So all the resources that are eligible for RA will be published. I guess the next question that comes to my mind is, so is this going to include all, like, including demand response, distributed resources located on the distribution circuit?
So, yeah, we're going to have to deal with things like demand response and storage and potentially DG.
Storage.
So things like that. Yeah, we're going to have to try to figure out methodologies to apply for all different resource types. So that's part of this process. We want to get input from everyone on how we would do those kind of things, what the best methodologies would be to explore, and then we can, talk through those and discuss it further.
So if the CAISO expands and the distributed generation model also expands, this will become a bigger administrative burden to do this function.
Yeah, potentially. I think at this point we believe that there's certain entities, jurisdictional entities, that may not want to take on additional roles, such as, calculating QC values for resources, and we believe that to have this more of a holistic approach, since we have all the kind of the pieces of the puzzle here, with an expanded DAA, that it would be appropriate for the ISO to determine what these values would be using those resources and publishing it so it was, transparent and everyone had that information ahead of time so they could do their procurement decisions based on that information or using that information.
Okay. So my next, I'm going to push this as a comment, maybe not a question, because this the counting methodologies then, with the role of the CPUC, at least for the California, then I'll just say that there's issue with the CAISOs, how they view resources, and the CPUC, how they view resources. What could that number that gets posted? Because I think I alluded to back there a while back, there's been disagreements on what a resource counts.
Mm-hmm.
And this would imply CAISO trumps.
Well, we need to try to determine a uniform methodology for all resource types across the footprint to be able to allow for, equitable trading and avoid leaning and those sort of things. So I think you have a fair point. It's an important issue. We're going to have to try to work through those things. I think we've got to talk with folks, try to align ourselves with how the way that, current entities do things to the extent possible and work through some of the tough, decisions that we're going to have to make on this.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Question. Michelle Keita from CPUC. So this is getting into the weeds, and I apologize to you all. There are NQCs for variable resources for all months of the year. But for local, we use the August value, and I'm wondering if you guys are proposing to use the monthly values or the August value as we currently do.
Could you repeat the question? I'm not
sure.
Clear.
So we have variable resources, right? Solar, wind resources. They have an August NQC value, but they also have monthly NQCs because we use the exceedance methodology. So in the summer, they count solar counts for a lot, and for in the shoulder months, it counts for less because it's not producing in the the higher net load periods, let's say. So we give it a lower NQC value in the other months. But for the local program, it's really kind of more like an annual program. So we have a very high local requirement because we look at a 1 in 10 August peak, and we determine the local requirements based on that. But we also use the NQC value for August. I'm wondering if you're going to continue with that sort of paradigm, this annual paradigm, or whether you're thinking that you would adopt the monthly NQCs for the variable resources.
This is Catalin with the ISO. This particular proposal doesn't change anything that has to do with local. This is only for system RA compliance, and for every month, every variable resource has its own number, and this is just to deal with the system RA compliance, not changing anything that has to do with local, which is done at the peak periods.
Okay, but you are determining the NQC values, and so I'm just saying in the current construct, we use the August NQC for local, and I guess I'm just asking whether in your paradigm you're proposing to change this or not.
We haven't got the details on that yet. So
okay, thank you.
I think that's a good question. That's something that we really need to think about, how we would do that. And so I don't want to jump to any conclusions yet on the actual decision we would make on that. But that should be part of this discussion as we go forward and try to determine what methodologies we're going to use. Thanks. Any other questions? Counting or backstop? Noah?
Yeah, I think I'm just going to echo what Steve Johnson said, in that it'd be really good to maybe have other technical workshops to discuss all these processes. And I know we're trying to only work up a framework, but in order to agree to a framework, all the stakeholders should understand the parts, even if they're not moving, to sign on to what the new structure might look like.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You know, we'll try to make sure that everyone is educated on these things and can comment in a good manner and have the full background there. So we'll talk about that internally. Any other questions or comments on any of this stuff? I'll move on to the other items we wanted to touch on through the end of the meeting here. So other items. These ones are kind of more minor. We just wanted to touch on briefly. I'll just run through the last couple real quickly and then open it up for questions. So allocation of RA requirements to LRAs or LSEs. This one is, our friends at Pacific Core had pointed out that right now we inform the local regulatory authorities of the local and flexible capacity needs, and then they allocate those to their jurisdictional LSEs. The ISO is seeing a need that we need to kind of broaden that and kind of make it a little bit more general, where we have a chance for LRAs to still continue to do that if they would like to take on that role. But in an expanded footprint, we also want to have the ability to just allocate those requirements directly to the LSEs themselves. So that's something that we're looking at, how we could do that under this initiative. It should be pretty straightforward, but it's just kind of another housekeeping item. The next one is updating the tariff language to be more generic.
Sorry. I just have one question.
Sure.
This is Kelsey from Pacific Core. On some of the things like that where it seems to be referenced a lot in your tariff, your current business practice manual, it'd be really helpful for us if you would cite maybe to what sections you're referencing. Like this one is pretty broad, at least from our perspective. It's a very large business practice manual.
Okay. Yeah, so... work through the details on this item and what we actually think we might need to do to effectuate this, that's going to be potentially maybe either tariff change or BPM change, and we'd have to try to determine that before we actually went down that path. We'd try to identify those things to folks. So I think that, that's a good point. We'll try to get some more detail on what areas we actually think need to be addressed under this one.
That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Yep. The next item is updating the tariff language to be more generic. So, again, another housekeeping item. Really, it's kind of just the fact that right now the tariff for RA purposes and numerous other areas says specific California-centric type language, like using the term CPUC, non-CPUC jurisdictional entities under the RA part of the tariff. So we need to make that more generic, and the intent here is just to allow for other regulatory authorities or LRAs or state commissions to be able to be recognized under this part of the tariff and to avoid creating any unintentional barriers if we expand to a larger BAA where there are multiple other entities outside of California that are taking place in these processes. We got a number of comments from stakeholders on this one, basically in support of eliminating these specific California references and trying to make it a little bit more generic. Also, folks wanted to make sure that we weren't intending there was any additional impact to the RA program or anything beyond just cleanup and avoiding those unintentional consequences. So, you know, again, the intent that is just going to affect only that part of the tariff. It's not really intended to change the RA program other than just to be flexible and allow for other entities to be recognized. So on those two items, I'll stop there and let people ask questions on either of those if they have any more on the allocation of requirements or updating the tariff language. Any questions? Those are pretty straightforward items, kind of minor. That's why I put them in the other items at the end. We'll get into a couple other issues. So I just want to raise, you know, the fact that we did get numerous comments in other areas that we wanted to at least acknowledge the fact that stakeholders had commented on a number of areas. You know, at this time, we believe that the scope of the proceeding here, or the initiative, is pretty well defined, and we've listed what we think is needed. And these following items we don't believe should be part of the scope of the RA, regional RA initiative. So there we got many comments on deliverability, how the deliverability methodology and analysis should be done, and that should be revisited for a larger footprint. The ISO does not believe that's necessary at this time. Another couple are local capacity study and requirements, flexible capacity study and requirements. Those two, again, we talked about this a little bit today, so we are still planning to do those in the same manner that we are today. We are still going to assess those under this reliability assessment for local and flexible needs, but the way we study them and the requirements that we determine through those studies would not need to be changed for expanding to a regional entity. That's what the ISO believes at this time. Again, we welcome more comments on this if folks have other ideas. But the other one we wanted to note was there was a number of comments about making major revisions to the RA construct. So, you know, talking about the efficiency of the bilateral market, bilateral procurement process and the current RA programs across the footprint or an expanded footprint. And the ISO believes at this time that we have no intention of you know, looking at making major revisions to the RA construct like that at all. You know, we're in a pretty tight time frame, and we definitely are not contemplating making any major revisions at this time. So, again, Appendix 1, I noted this earlier, but I'll note it again. We have the stakeholder comment matrix, so that includes all these comments and ISO responses in the paper. If folks want to take a look and dig into those in more detail. Also, all of the comments themselves are posted online on the same website for the initiative as well, if you wanted to read those. And then the last bullet here is we have a suggestion to identify the LSEs in potentially a new footprint area under PacifiCorp, and people also asked for information related to the transmission paths and the potential or the available transfer capability on those, or total transfer capability and those kind of things. So we do have part of the appendix of the proposal as well has links to the transmission map that PacifiCorp has given us. It's their OASIS transmission map, and it includes the different branch groups and what kind of transfer capability they have. So that's kind of interesting if folks want to look at that. That was very helpful. Also, they included provided us with a list of LSEs in their footprint, and we worked with them to be able to also provide that in the SRAP proposal. So those are just a couple items that we wanted to give folks to take a look at and have some more information related to potential new entrants into the ISO BAA. So with that, I'll open it up for any final questions on any of these other items or anything we talked about so far. No?
No, Thomas, just one last comment. With regards to the flexible capacity study and requirements, given that ISO is perhaps in the future looking into the using imports to meet the flexible requirements and using the new methodology for non-coincident peak for the MIC allocation, whether or not that's consistent with how the flexible capacity requirement study is actually done, which is based on coincident peak. So I wanted to, if the ISO could think about that a little bit more, because if you're going to leave that out of scope of this initiative, what impacts are you having with the MIC allocation?
Okay, so let me just reply and try to summarize what you said so I make sure I got it right. But do you want us to make sure that any of the changes that we propose to the MIC to potentially look at different peaking areas non-simultaneously wouldn't have an impact on the flexible capacity requirements?
Whether or not the resources that are being going to be able to be used to meet that that requirement is consistent with the methodology that was used to determine the requirement.
Okay. Catalin, do you want to talk to that at all, or do we need to take that back and talk about it a little bit more internally and think about it?
I'll talk with Carl, but I think in response to yours, I think the MIC, the only thing that MIC actually gives you is what portion of the intertie capacity you can use for array. And yes, you can use a resource behind that to make even flexible, but I don't think the size of the pipe would actually dictate if you're going to be able to use it or not. So I'm just leaving you with that train of thought, but I will talk to Carl to make sure that flexible, this small change in MIG that we're trying to propose here does not impact flexible.
And as well as how the internal constraints that you guys are envisioning in adding might cause other requirements or other constraints to for meeting that requirement.
Okay, duly noted.
Can I ask a rephrasing maybe of part of Noah's question? This is Meredith from the PC. So currently, and again, this is weedy, so apologies to everyone else, but currently the flexible requirement is set based on the maximum three-hour ramping need for a given month. And so first we have to understand how that would be measured in a regional balancing area. Would you be looking over the entire balancing area? I mean, we don't currently have like a local flexible requirement where we only say what is the need in Southern California, what is the need in San Diego or Northern California. We look over the entire state. So would we change that, or would we maintain that we're going to measure the maximum three-hour ramp over this potentially huge balancing area, in which case it might be really small?
Yeah, so that's one of the benefits of having a larger footprint. And again, we don't intend to make changes on this flexible capacity study. So, yeah, I would just respond that I don't think that it would be necessary to make those kind of changes under this. But Carl just told me that he's actually on the phone, so let's open it up and see if
If Carl has plans for actually doing some of this analysis, that would be helpful to know also. Thanks.
Sure. So can you ask to open up Carl Musin's line, please?
Operator, can you open up the line of Carl Musin? Carl, go ahead and enter the queue if you're just dialing in.
Carl, could you please press #2 on your phone? Go ahead. Your line is unmuted.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Carl. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I've always wanted to say that, by the way. yes, I understand the question about, you know, will MIC, the changes that are being proposed to MIC impact what's happening, for example, in FRAC Move 2 as we're looking at flexible capacity on the interties. You know, it's not clear at this point in time that, you know, what Catalin is proposing or what they're discussing for any of the minor changes for MIC determination would have a negative impact on what would be permitted for flexible capacity on the ties. And I think Chris also did a really nice job summarizing some of the benefits of the expanded footprint is the ability to try and, again, kind of utilize all LSE's resources to kind of manage the three-hour net load ramp and kind of distribute when that ramp is occurring and kind of moving a diverse portfolio of loads into the ISO. So we're maybe managing overall shorter three-hour ramps just because of the load profiles.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. That's some good additional information. I'm glad you're on the phone there to help out. Does anyone else have any other questions on the flexible piece while Carl's available? Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Nora Sheriff for CLECA. Carl, I have a clarifying question on what you just said. Did you mean maybe managing overall less steep three-hour ramps. You said overall shorter three-hour ramps because of the load profile. But
yeah, good point, Nora. So what I really was talking about is right now when we're looking at California, again, just to kind of put it in context, you know, we're looking at a 10,000 megawatt three-hour net load ramp. If we diversified loads when peak loads are occurring, maybe we can reduce that three-hour net load ramp from 10,000 to, let's say, 8,000 just because of a more diverse load profile. So, again, typically looking, again, at 3 hours, but just, again, fewer megawatt range up over which we're trying to ramp.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, Peter Griffiths, PG&E. Carl, have you done any analysis? Because in my mind, that would be an empirical question as to what the flexibility and the requirements are that are joining the system. So I guess have you done analysis to that effect?
We're still in.
And those are the results of the analysis.
We're still in a very preliminary look at that, Peter. Once we have, again, I think Chris mentioned this earlier, we are trying to have some more empirical information out. Chris, correct me if I misstate this, but sometime around the next iteration, having some more numbers and analysis to present to the stakeholders.
Okay, we'll look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, great. Hopefully we can get more of that for everyone. But I'm going to cut it off on the flexible because we're going to try to wrap this up here. We got 10 more minutes left, so
all right.
Get the next steps and all that. But is there any other questions or any follow-up questions on anything else so far? Sure.
It's more of a comment. This is Margaret Miller.
Oh, wait, press it. Don't hold it down. Just press it once. It's still not working. Apparently not.
I'm being cut off.
There you go. Okay, you should be good now.
You have control up there.
Okay, go ahead, Margaret.
Sorry, this is Margaret Miller with Customized Energy Solutions. Just a comment just from hearing what has been discussed today, that it seems to me that it would help if we got a better understanding of what the level of detail that the CAISO believes that you need to take this to the board in June. I think there's some elements here that seem like they need a lot more, and determine what elements here need more technical discussion. If those discussions need to happen before the board or after the board, do they need to happen in this forum, or do we need to carve out some of these items into separate technical working groups that feed back into the process? And then what items, if any, really belong in technical discussions after the board, if we can get to a level of agreement that gives us enough direction to take it to the board, and then maybe it belongs in a BPM discussion after the board. So I think it would help a lot in moving this effort forward to kind of have that type of roadmap of these different elements of the proposal and where we think they go and how we can move them forward. Just a suggestion.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We heard a lot of that today about the details and again, we try to keep it high level on this iteration. Want to try to get to more details later, but I think that's a really good point. Hopefully we can try to provide a little bit more context about what the ISO's position is on those sort of questions. But I also really want to welcome stakeholder input on that stuff. So if, you know, folks have ideas on that now, what they think needs to happen before the next iteration, please put those in your written comments or, you know, comment right now on that. So go ahead, Steve. Do you have any follow-ups? Sorry, Mark, you good? Okay, yep, thanks.
Yeah, and Steve Jensen, I'll follow up with that. I think that's a very good comment, and I just add that which board?
Yeah, so that's, again, that's probably the one of those governance questions, so I'll hold off on answering on that. Any other questions? All right, I'll turn it back over to Christina.
Okay. So the next steps, we do greatly appreciate your feedback as we develop this proposal. So if you can provide the comments that you made today, if you can provide those in your written comments to us, anything else you can think of, those will be due March 16th. We do have a comments template available on the website. We ask that you use that template. You can submit those to initiativecomments@caiso.com. And it looks like Chris has bravely offered his email address on this presentation. So if you have any follow-up questions, you can contact Chris. We do appreciate you coming out today. You know, we ordered this spring-like weather just for you because in the next 5 days it's supposed to rain solid and the temperature's going to drop. So enjoy it while you can, and safe travels home.